This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Jim Modern. Today is August 10, 2010. I'm in Lubbock, Texas in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Modern is joining me by phone from California. Okay, why don't we begin with a little bit of biographical information, if you don't mind. First of all, when and where were you born?
I was born in Twin Falls, Idaho, which is south central Idaho, on May 26, 1948.
Okay.
I was raised in that town until I graduated from high school.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names and what did they do for a living?
Sure. My father, Ben Modern, was a owner and operator of a major business in town with his brother-in-law and good friend, Ted Smith. They ran a restaurant. They employed about 130 people. It was a scratch restaurant.
Okay.
And they, my father had grown up in northern Idaho on an Indian reservation in Worley, and had a break to go to the University of Idaho, and majored in business and graduated, and I believe in 1940, and was married to a high school friend of Ted Smith, his future business partner and brother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
He served in the Navy. He told me a story that when Pearl Harbor happened, he and thousands of other people were in Lewiston, Idaho to enlist.
Okay.
The line was long, and do you want me to keep on going or should I stop?
No, sure, absolutely.
Okay, the line was four or five blocks long, and a man came down the line asking if people had a college degree. Dad was one of the few that raised his hands, and the man asked, "What was your degree in?" Dad said, "Business." And the man said, "You are a Navy supply officer. Go to table 14.
Wow.
And he went, signed up, and fretted for about 3 weeks because no one in the Worley Spokane area really knew what a Navy supply officer's uniform looked like.
Okay.
They found one. He went back to Harvard for a accelerated supply school.
Mm-hmm.
And graduated and was served on a flagship in the Med, and told me many wonderful stories of his time in the Navy.
Mm.
My mother, Thelma, was a real rambunctious lady who grew up in Boise. She liked history, and unfortunately, she died a day after my sister was born, 3 years after I was born. So,
right.
So initially, I had a family that was my grandmother, who took my mother's place, and my father. My father remarried when I was in the fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a family that was focused on sports. I liked shooting. I was a class officer in my high school, and I always liked the Navy.
Okay.
Twin Falls was a very stable community then. I have a picture of about 15 children in a kindergarten class, and all but two of them graduated with me from high school.
Mm, okay. All right. Well, you mentioned your dad's service in the Navy. Did that have an impact on your desire to serve in the Navy?
It did, but it not intentionally. The first thing I remember ever about the Navy is, of course, seeing my father's uniform items. He stayed in the reserves as I think you had to during the Korean War, and he told me once that he even considered going back in the service when the Korean War started up.
Mm-hmm.
But my first memory of the Navy was I was going with my grandmother to the post office, and on the steps of the big stone steps of the post office was a Navy recruiting poster or metal sign with a guy in a Cracker Jack uniform, and I said, "Who's that person? What's he doing?" And my grandmother said, "That's a Navy man. Your father was in the Navy,
mm-hmm.
and he liked it." And I thought, that sounds like maybe something for me.
Mm-hmm.
So led into, unintentionally, a real interest in ships, both sailing ships and warships. I put models together. I read everything I could find in the library, and probably by the time I was 6th or 7th grade, I really knew I wanted to go to sea, which was interesting because I had never seen the sea at that time.
Right, right.
And that, so I was focused on that, but my father always told good stories. Well, he told good and bad stories of his time in the service.
Mm-hmm.
Good times when, or funny times when he and a Marine Corps guard were armed and carried $120,000 in small bills for payday. He was a paymaster on a cruiser.
Okay.
And so the stories were interesting, and yet he didn't mince words that he didn't like being seasick. He didn't like the mutton that they fed day after day because that's all the Navy could give them.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a glorious pick time, but it was something he liked, he respected, and I just came to love ships and thought I'd like to see.
Mm-hmm. All right. As a kid growing up there, did you talk to him much about, did you tell him that you wanted to join the Navy one day as well?
I didn't really know initially in grade school if it was the Army or Navy. I just liked military things. Cowboys were real big then, so I liked cavalry things.
Right.
Davy Crockett, things like that. It sort of formed, though, by the time I was in high school, I discovered that my great-uncle, my grandfather's brother, had been in the Navy in World War I.
Okay.
He was a yeoman on a ship, USS West APOM, A-P, what is that? A, let's see, it is APAUM, SP-332.
Okay.
And he was promoted from a seaman to a yeoman second class in about 3 years and thought about staying in the Navy, decided not to, went back to Worley. But I think I pretty much made the decision myself, and I did it because I wanted adventure. I knew the Navy would give that to me, but join the Navy, see the world was the theme at the time, one of the recruiting themes, and that was effective for me.
Mm-hmm.
I liked guns. And I liked, I guess, I may have liked the tradition around ships.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Mentioning your great uncle, then your family then had a long history of serving in the Navy, correct?
We did, although the person I'm named for actually served in the Army. He was a first and then a second lieutenant in the Confederacy.
Okay.
And I was horrified about when I was a lieutenant commander to discover that I was named after a rebel. I was absolutely horrified. It took me about 7 years to reconcile myself to states' rights. We did not have slaves, but it was just horrible for me.
Right.
I eventually retraced his steps. He was captured at Vicksburg. He
mm-hmm.
was guarded by a cousin from Iowa, which was interesting.
Huh, wow, that is.
The family split. The unit, 59th Tennessee Mounted Infantry Regiment, was exchanged, and they all bought horses because they didn't want to walk anymore, as the story goes back in East Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And they became a cavalry unit and eventually were pulled out of East Tennessee as the Confederacy declined. And after Appomattox, serendipitously, they became Jefferson Davis's bodyguard.
Wow.
And
okay.
So his unit stayed with Davis for 3 or 4 weeks that Davis was on the run from the Federal Army after him.
Right.
And eventually... Davis released the troops, and they came back, and so that's the history. But he was serving. We had a relative that was in the Revolutionary War. We came over in 1751.
Huh, right.
Fought in the were there in the middle of the French and Indian War on the western Pennsylvania frontier. And Revolutionary War, and then the family moved down following Daniel Boone in the 1780s and went into the state of Franklin, which the Congress did not recognize, eventually became became Tennessee.
Mm, right.
And Nicholas Jr. was with Jackson, Jackson's troops, Andrew Jackson, and was one of the regiments that was in Mobile instead of New Orleans. There was a question whether the British would land at New Orleans or Mobile, Alabama. He was at Mobile.
Okay.
So the history up until my great uncle was all Army, but that didn't have much, for some reason, much attraction to me, probably because they didn't have ships.
Right, right. All right. This history of your family, was this something that you you discovered as a kid or later on?
Well, the history came out later on, and I took it into my own responsibility to find out where we came from. My father, people in genealogy are either very interested or could not care less. My father was in the latter camp.
Right.
I asked him once where we came from, and I was in the fifth grade, and he just said, well, Tennessee, I think. And that didn't satisfy me because obviously Europeans in North America didn't come from Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I pretty much did this on my own 15, 20 years ago.
Okay.
But we did have the history from Uncle Dave, who was in the Navy, and certainly my father's personal experience, which he shared with me whenever I asked.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. All right. Well, where'd you go to high school?
Went to high school, Twin Falls High School. It was a three-year high school. It had been built in, I think, 52, 53, and was extremely good condition. Still is actually in service. And played sports, had fun going to school, was senior class vice president. We'd still get together for reunions. Got one coming up next year.
Hmm.
So it was just was a grand time for me, and many of my very good friends are just still as part of the Twin Falls experience.
Mm-hmm. All right. Were you in high school when the Kennedy assassination happened?
Well, I was in high school in Spanish class when it happened.
Mm.
And came over the school intercom, which was not used for anything at all. In fact, we were a little surprised that it was actually put on, came on. And initially, some of the class was happy. Idaho was very conservative. Had gone for Goldwater.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
And actually, it was Nixon. Excuse me. It was Nixon and Kennedy. And it didn't take me. It took a while for me to understand really truly what it means when a person dies, and certainly after that, the impact on a nation when the president dies in office, even more tragically assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
I was in Spanish class, and I think it was in the morning, sitting third row when the announcement came.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you mentioned sports. What type of sports did you play?
Oh, about anything I could. I wasn't big enough to be good at football, but I played it. My best sport was baseball. We played, my father coached our team from the first grade to the ninth grade. And we got pretty good. We won 117 games and lost 17.
Oh, wow.
And I played second base. I played basketball through junior high, but then got into wrestling because at 5'8", you're not going to be a good tall man's game, and I played football and then ran track. So I did basically four sports around the year, like most of my friends.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. So I imagine that kept you pretty busy.
Well, it did, plus school things. I usually had to study about an hour and a half, 2 hours every night because some subject I wasn't the sharpest pencil in the the pouch, and others was really easy. History was extremely easy for me. English was easy.
Mm-hmm.
Math and was more difficult. Actually, the most difficult science was in between.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, as you were going through high school, were you paying attention to what was going on in the world with U.S. foreign policy and the Cold War? Did you pay much attention to that?
Well, a bit, but when you're on the Southern Idaho farming community or Center for a Farming Community, you're focusing in high school on sports, on food, on classes, on girls.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't spend a lot of time, but clearly the Vietnam, the situation in Vietnam gathered more and more attention. And starting probably our sophomore year in high school, the Army recruiters, Army Reserve recruiters, there's a regiment in Twin Falls, started paying recruiting calls to the high school.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly it was going on. I actually, I remember this my senior year, they did not get much any attendance in their booth, and I felt sorry for them, so I gave them my name, and they kept calling on my dad, and
right.
My dad finally came to me and said, "Jim, do you want to be in the Army?" And I said, "No, Dad, I want to be in the Navy." So he told them. But I thought it was, in hindsight, looking back, as they were talking to my father instead of talking to me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we knew things were going on, but they were far away, and other events, other activities were more present in our life.
Right, right. Okay. Well, had anyone from your high school gone to Vietnam, though, or been drafted during this time?
We didn't start having people do that until our senior year.
Okay.
And we had probably a half dozen people, of which two were killed, Herman Lohman and Larry Coates. Larry was on the wrestling team with me. Herman was a wrestler also. They both enlisted in the Marines, one during the year and one after graduation, and unfortunately both were killed. One in 67 and I think one 68.
Mm.
We had a number of other people that served. James Peterson, who went in the Army and became Special Forces, he and I are good friends. He lives on a boat in Bermuda right now, and I just exchanged emails with him this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a couple other, one guy was in the Air Force, but as I think about this, my thinking, Jason, is that there were surprisingly few of us that went to the war, probably because the troop needs came several years after.
Mm-hmm.
The big troop buildup came several years after.
Right. All right. Well, I know you mentioned at this point you had told your dad that you wanted to go into the Navy as opposed to the Army, but did you go in at this time, or was it on to college upon graduation?
Well, I went on to college. My dad was the alumni president of the University of Idaho alumni.
Okay.
And he always said that the University of Idaho was his first big break from the Indian Reservation, where my grandfather ran the general store and really loved Idaho. And I told him once I was going to go down and interview with Stanford, and he was so upset with me. But anyway, I went to the University of Idaho, and I tried to get into NROTC, the Navy ROTC program, and couldn't because the eyesight requirements was 20/20.
Mm.
I had 20, probably 2150, 2200 at the time. So unfortunately, I couldn't get in, so I decided to try for a two-year scholarship instead of the four-year scholarship, and I took naval science classes for 2 years, and then eventually was able to pass the eyesight test to get into the two-year program. In fact, I had to memorize the eye chart. I watched closely how the gunner's mate chief did the eye test. It was always left to right, and there were seven letters on the line. That was pretty easy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I said I can memorize seven letters, which I did.
Right.
So I memorized the eye chart and got accepted, even though at that time the eyesight had come down to 20/100, and I was probably still a little bit above that.
Okay.
And interesting enough, the draft was started in 1969 in my fraternity, which we had about 65 guys living in, another 30 on campus, Sigma Alpha Epsilon, and we had about half of the people were in some ROTC unit. Idaho is a land-grant institution, and you had, just before we had arrived on, I arrived on campus, it was a requirement everyone up through their sophomore year had to be in an ROTC unit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That requirement was not in place when I was a freshman. We had probably about half the people, and so anyway, here I am as a junior, getting paid, I think, $75 a month, which I thought was really neat, getting books and tuition, and my draft number comes out at 357.
Okay.
Which was quite good, since they went to 195 that year.
Ah, right.
But I decided that I still wanted to be in the Navy. I mean, why not?
Mm-hmm.
And also, I saw the Navy as one ticket, and certainly the best option I knew of, to get out of Twin Falls, to get out of Idaho, to see the world, have the adventure, and then figure out what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I stayed in the Navy program, and it was actually the classes were held in a Quonset hut-like building that was constructed for World War II radio operators when the nation mobilized for World War II. So it's quite a history there. And
right.
I've been back in the same building two or three times, and it's just interesting to be back in a place that you sat at and listened to and scratch your head when you're trying to do celestial navigation, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
A funny thing happened to me, a little story. I decided, though, although I liked the Navy and I liked the uniforms, I liked ships, I detested marching. I did not like marching.
Right.
And we had drill, I think, every Thursday. So I was a student, but I was the junior class president. So I told my Navy instructors that I had class officer activities on during drill, and they were so delighted to have a class officer in the battalion. Because of the growing unrest on their cross campuses, they said, "Sure, Jim, excuse me."
Mm-hmm.
The next year, I was elected to the five-man executive board, which is, I guess, the student senate.
Okay.
And I applied for and received another dispensation from attending drill, so I barely knew how to drill. So the irony upon irony is about 6 months, actually 3 months into my first deployment, the captain calls me up to the bridge on my destroyer and says, "I want you to form with your division on the ASROC deck. I want to inspect them." So I was frantic. How in the hell do I do this? I should have gone to drill.
Right.
And so I just remembered basically form two lines, and I said, "Okay, first line, three steps forward, march." And division ready for your inspection, sir. That's Fortunately, I just I barely knew how to get through that.
Right.
So I was pleased to be in ROTC. It was commissioned, I believe, on the 30th of May, 1970.
Okay.
We were commissioned with in the gym, the parents and students, and the Army and Air Force cadets, as well as the midshipmen. And we're all commissioned, and I was surprised at the time, but the whole gym stood up and gave us a standing ovation, which I was, I didn't realize, you know, why they make such a fuss over us, but I just remembered that happened.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Well, the ROTC training, was it all done there at the campus, or was there a summer camp or a cruise as well?
Well, one of the program then, I think it still is now, the combination of classroom and summer cruises.
Okay.
Because I was only a two-year midshipman instead of a four-year, I didn't go to the cruise between my freshman and sophomore and the one between my sophomore and junior years. So I missed out going playing a Marine, which they did one summer, and then going working one summer as an enlisted. So I got to my senior cruise, which you basically are a sub-junior officer, I guess is the way to say it, midshipman first class.
Okay.
And I had the opportunity to take, I'd been on a destroyer, USS Isabel, picked it up in Long Beach on a cruise called Pac Mitterrand. There are probably 800 or so midshipmen with about five destroyers in the battleship New Jersey.
Mm.
We went up to San Francisco and then ended up to Seattle and over to Hawaii and then San Diego and back to Long Beach. That was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Got seasick for my first time, which was not fun, but I certainly liked the different ports. And coming into Hawaii, I still remember that was the first landing on the moon. And we got into Pearl Harbor on the celebration of the announcement just happened about 4 hours, 5 hours prior to our arrival of the first landing on the moon. And the whole town was just celebrating for America and the scientific achievements. Just, it was really, really exciting time.
Right. Yes, sir. How long did this cruise last?
Those cruises lasted, I believe, 5 weeks. I could be wrong, but I think 5 weeks, between 5 and 7 weeks. So basically, it fit in summer. It was, you got paid okay, better mm-hmm. than the construction job I had, or road construction. And it was a chance to taste Navy life, stood watches. They sent us out to social events with local port girls. Some were ugly, some were really cute.
right.
But they're about, I think, 5 to 6 weeks, 5 to 7 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a full summer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
One of the unanticipated side effects of that cruise is I came back with a real bad vocabulary. I came back here I was 20 or 21 at the time, and I came back and it was I was probably pretty foul mouthed.
Uh-huh. Right.
Around my friends. My parents had a sort of funny. My parents, unbeknownst to me, had a Japanese Japanese exchange student living in their house.
Mm.
And I came back and I'd been at sea, just boisterous and just having a lot of fun. I came in and pushed open my door and yelled, "I'm home!" And there was this little Japanese girl saw me and she went and retreated in the corner. She didn't know what to make of me, and I said, "Who are you and what are you doing here?" And I was pretty boisterous at that time. Glad to be at home, really proud of what I had done.
Right.
And I was feeling pretty good about myself.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Well, did you feel that the ROTC training overall was pretty good, prepared you for Navy life?
No way.
Okay.
What, and you'll hear this maybe in a few minutes why I say that, but it was academically good, basically, naval history, which I liked a lot, but navigation, which, since I'm not a math whiz, was a bit of a challenge, but I passed that.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the gunnery section, but it didn't really give you the skills that I needed on ship as a junior officer. First would have been maneuvering the ship. and the midshipmen in the Naval Academy get that because they go on YPs, which are coastal patrol craft, and they do maneuvering, they do signals, they do all these things. And when you're landlocked in northern Idaho, Moscow, Idaho, you don't maneuver, you don't take radio commands, you don't break signals and form screens, do corpons, that type of thing.
Okay.
That was the first thing that was tragically missing. And second was you don't have the good experience of leading men in a real deep and encompassing way. Fortunately, with being active on sports teams and being a student politician in my fraternity, I was a fairly good leader, but I was really tried and tested the first year when I was on my ship.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I knew the Navy. I knew the basics, but I really had to scramble the first 6 months on to be on the bridge. I really needed to. I was really stretched when I had to be a disciplinarian to people my own age who. Some of them didn't want to be in the service. Many of them didn't want to be in the service, or others were had chronic problems. And I had two guys in my division that were old enough to be my father, my two chiefs. So it was a real mixed bag, and I grew remarkably probably the first 6 months.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, before we get in any further into your first assignment there, if you could talk a little bit more about college. What was the atmosphere like on the campus there at that time? Was there much in the way of war protests, things like that, going on campus?
War protests did not. The first several years there were none. It wasn't until my senior year. That there was open protests, and started off with a half dozen people, and it may have increased to 50 or 60. But Idaho then, the university was conservative, reflecting the state, which is very conservative still. And yet it was hard not to notice on nightly news the body count. The network news certainly, in retrospect, took upon themselves of taking the war to people's front rooms. And there was a increasing gloom in people's view of the war and people and how that then came out into society and how you thought about the government and other things. So there was a growing concern, a deepening problem, obviously, and did not seem to be a good way out, especially in putting more troops went in, more died, and it did not seem to be too many leaks in the bucket, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And probably the one major leak is Haiphong was open for munition importation, and that's probably was the most classic mistake that the LBJ administration and others made.
Okay.
But right. I would say that the first 3 years there was nothing. The last year there was considerable. And yet, we're moderate in terms of the student body. But again, I can reflect back on the standing ovation that the new commissioned officers received. I think that's an indication of what the people at that graduation ceremony thought of the people being commissioned.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, Had you been following developments fairly closely yourself, and if so, you talked about this, but had you formed much of an opinion at this point?
Well, it was hard not to follow in developments as the troop as the troop numbers came up when draft was instituted, it's hard not to be affected on that.
Mm-hmm.
My draft number, extremely high draft number, gave me peace of mind. I could do what I wanted, and I thought that I still want to be in the Navy, and the Navy's going to be over there.
Right.
So I certainly did think about it. It certainly did affect some of my friends. And there were student deferments then, so my world revolved around the University of Idaho, and people stayed in school because if they got out or dropped out, they'd be drafted. One guy that happened to one of my friends who was in another fraternity, he was in our ROTC unit, and he decided one semester that he was just going to drink instead of go to class, and he flunked out, and the next summer, someone came back from my fraternity and they said, oh, by the way, Petty Officer McKinney said to say hello to you. And I said, what? He said, yeah, he's a singleman on this destroyer I was on, and he said to say hello. And this was a guy who was one of my not close friends, but I knew him well, and he flunked out, and he got drafted 2 weeks later and was sent to a destroyer. So,
right.
So it was certainly were ramifications of not doing well in school, and it was you could sense that the government was increasingly looking for bodies, needing troops, and there were McNamara at the time, either at that time or when I was in the service, already in the service, lowered the recruiting standards to Category 3 and 4, which would be aptitude and intelligence on standard tests. And it was clear that the military needed more people and was starting to vacuum men from the street into uniform.
Right, right. All right. So you graduated from college in May of 1970?
Yes, I did.
Okay, and was commissioned at that point. And did you go directly in at that point, or did you have a little time off before reporting for your first assignment?
I had 3 weeks off, and I just sort of piddled around. I don't remember what I did, but nothing of merit, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
I reported on my destroyer, the USS Agerholm, DD-826 in San Diego, in June. It may have been the 20th, 21st. I have the report date somewhere in my papers. And it was interesting because the ship had just come through refresher training. It had been in the yards and then went through refresher training, which is a very, very intensive period of training as teams, training as individual skills, and testing.
Okay.
And everyone was on leave, getting as much as they could because we were getting ready to deploy in July. So I show up to this destroyer. I get my stateroom, which we call the former the forward broom closet, and I basically stood watches. There wasn't anything much going on because everyone was getting ready to deploy, and I didn't really appreciate that. And I thought, okay, I can do this, and so that's what I did. That's sort of my transition from Idaho into the Navy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. You mentioned these exercises. What had the Agerholm been doing prior to that? Where had it been operating? Do you know?
Well, the Agerholm, like other Pacific destroyers, was on a rotation between the Western Pacific, which is primarily Vietnam, and the West Coast. So,
okay.
So the ship would be 6 months over, 6 months back, or 6 months over, and then back for 9 months or so. There was, the rotation period had stepped up probably 2 years prior to my joining the ship.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the ships and crew, the ships were old. My ship was commissioned in 1940. 45.
Okay.
I was older than most of the people on the ship. And it had been modernized in the mid-60s. It's called FRAM, F-R-A-M. It was a FRAM 1. It was modernized from the main deck up to support a drone. The first, we now call them UAVs.
Mm-hmm.
It was a drone called DASH, D-A-S-H, Drone Anti-Submarine Helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
It was an abysmal failure. Technology just wasn't ready for the Navy at sea. And all these destroyers, World War II vintage destroyers, were slowly being just worn down. You could tell on the ship it was old. Rust, chipping rust, paint over rust was the major activity of the deck division. About 40 guys. We were between Midway and Guam, probably over one of the deepest parts of the ocean anywhere in the world, and somebody chipping paint in the boiler room chipped through the hull.
Oh, wow.
And we had to put what called, it was epoxy, basically, sort of like clay, I guess, to put on it, called the Snipes, which was a name for engineers, called it monkey shit. So they basically just slapped that on, and but it was just like, but we could tell the ship was old. We were in a situation where I really love to fire four-gun salvos, but when you do that, urinals would spring off the bulkhead, air conditioners, and the captain's in-port cabin would crash onto the floor, and the damage control assistant, DCAA, would just really get pissed at me. I really liked it, and everyone else liked it too, but
right.
It just really tore the ship apart.
Uh-huh. Right. All right. Well, could you, I guess, talk about things like your quarters, and could you describe that?
Yeah, we had the officers on this tin can. The ship was commissioned in 45. They said it was part of a war design and remodeled weapons wise, but not creature comfort-wise. We had it was 390 feet long. We had a complement, which was really what you need to run the ship according to the operating manual, 350. We had about 335 all the time.
Okay.
18, 20 officers and the rest enlisted, of which we probably had 20, 25 chiefs. And the chiefs really were the key element in the Navy on the ship. But my forward officer area was right next. It was a bulkhead, and the bulkhead is like a eighth inch of aluminum between chief's quarters and the forward officers. We had three staterooms that we call the forward broom closet. I shared mine with a former tackle from the Naval Academy, and two of us couldn't stand up in the stateroom at the same time, so we would dress and leave, come and go at different times. I had the top deck, and no, I guess I had the bottom deck, and he had the top deck. But so we had six guys in a space probably of about 60 square feet.
Right.
It'd be about half. It'd be about third. Look at my desk here. It'd be the width of a desk about 3 feet, and then a chest of drawers another 3 feet, so it's probably 6 feet by 3 feet, so it's 18 feet floor space, maybe 20.
Right. Okay.
And there'd be six of us in three staterooms, each about that size, and then outside in a passageway there was a commode and a shower.
Okay.
And that was our stateroom, quote unquote. You know, the palatial thing we had.
Right.
So the crew, that was actually though better than the crew, because they slept in crew compartments. There were about 30 men in a compartment, and they were organized by division, which meant by work assignment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The gunners, mates, and fire control technicians, my guys, slept in the same compartment. The snipes slept in the different one, the radio men in another one, that, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So my first stateroom was really this itty-bitty thing, and later when I got more seniority for the second deployment, I was put in after. I had enough seniority to get in after officer's quarters, and I shared with another guy, but it was about three times the size. So we could probably put, when we want to get together and talk, probably put six guys in there, and we could put a dartboard,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of fun, because depending on how the ship was moving at the time, the dartboard would go back and forth.
Right.
So you would have to, depending on the motion of the ship, you'd have to throw the dart at the board where it was going to be, not where it was.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
The quarters were fairly Spartan. Crucial to enjoyment was air conditioning and fresh water. The ship was old. It produced fresh water from evaporators that generally worked, but when you were at sea for quite a while, they would tend to break down or they would reduce efficiency. So
mm-hmm.
It was not a surprise. We'd be out usually for 30 days at a time, maybe 45. Usually about your 20th day, we would start talking about going on water hours, which meant that the fountains, the bubblers in the passageways would be turned off and only turned on for several two-hour segments during the day.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Water on the ship was prioritized for boilers first, food and food preparation second, drinking third, and personal hygiene fourth.
Mm. Okay.
It turned out to be water was real important. When we got over to Asia, it would be easily 100, 110 degrees, especially off the gun line, off a 2-core.
Right.
And air conditioning was just you acclimated to a certain state, but you're the only place that truly was air conditioned was the captain's stateroom, and no one really wanted to be in there because it was not good news if you had to go there.
Mm-hmm.
Or the electronic spaces, and a lot of the real smart enlisted electronic technicians probably slept in the where the radios were and everything else just because it was air conditioned.
Right.
So
right.
It's hard to sleep when it's 104 degrees, 105 degrees in your compartment and you're sweating.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So what turned out to be really, really good for myself and the other five officers in forward officers' quarters is that we were right next to the chief's quarters, I think I mentioned a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the chiefs are the technicians that really run a ship. And when we go on water hours, for some strange thing, reason that chief's quarters never went on water hours.
Right.
So we always had showers, and we decided among us we were not going to squawk because we were on the same valve system as the chiefs. So we said, this is okay, we'll just be mum about it.
Mm-hmm.
When you're at sea, you get salt grime on you, and you get, as the ship turns, if you're doing watches outside, and I would be outside on the decks or on the bridge wings, you often get cinders or, let's say, stack gas on you, so you get soot in your body, and you get certainly grease all around you. And
mm-hmm.
if you don't wash yourself, gets into your sheets, pretty soon you have this film and this, it's hard to keep if you like to keep yourself really clean,
right.
Which I did and still do. Mm-hmm. It was hard. So I really thought it turned out to be a good deal.
Right.
In that that we were next to the chiefs.
Right. Right.
So the ship was, we had about 335 guys. my part of the ship, we had 4 5-inch 38 guns mounted in two twin forward mounts, and so you'd have a mount with two twin guns, and it was two side-by-side guns. You'd have right below that, you'd have a ready handling room where you'd have the powder and the projectiles in two rotating concentric circles.
Okay.
That would go up a hoist into the gun, and then down below the upper the ready handling room would be the magazines where the shells and the powder were kept for storage.
All right. Well, before getting further into your assignment and your job, I could ask you a little bit about your impressions of the crew itself. You don't have to go into specific names if you don't want to, but if you could talk a little bit about the crew and some of the personalities you ran into, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure. Before I do that, I just thought of something I neglected to tell you.
Okay.
And it was your question a few minutes ago about reporting on board.
Mm-hmm.
And that 3 weeks I had by myself, was quite interesting. Remember the first, and I had always been, my first experience, my first day of report on board, and it was assigned watch, and I had a officer who was a JG, so he was commissioned the year ahead of me, and unbeknownst to me that he had put me on the mid-watch also. So I had officer deck, basically the import quarterdeck, and then I did work until about 10 o'clock or so. No one told me I had the midnight watch, and that guy turned out to be oily, that he always liked to play little tricks on me, so I'm sort of getting to your question.
Okay.
But what really struck me at that 3 weeks is that San Diego in summer 1970, for me, in my 4 or 5 guys from the University of Idaho who were commissioned and assigned to San Diego, was really sort of like the endless summer.
Mm-hmm.
The weather was really, really nice. We had money. I had my car, a 67 Mustang.
Oh, wow, right.
There, it was really cool.
Uh-huh.
And every night, if you wanted to go, and I didn't, but every night there would be a major party at a place, so everyone knew that Friday night was Marine Corps Recruit Depot. That Sunday night was the Downwinds on North Island. Thursday night was the Miramar Officers Club. And these events were very much like Officer and a Gentleman,
mm-hmm.
or like Top Gun in those bar scenes where
right.
guys, not necessarily in the uniform, but women, and it was just young, it was fun, and I'm still struck by that 3 weeks. It was really dreamy, it
mm-hmm.
was a lot of fun, and it was nothing like my life was going to be.
Right, right.
So that was something I did not tell you, but it was still a memory I will always have with me, how much fun I had, how dreamy it was, simply because of the weather.
Mm-hmm.
Events and just how easy things were at the time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But going from that question, though, or any questions before I go to your question about the people?
No, I don't suppose so.
The ship was interesting. This was my first experience, in retrospect, in a blue-collar environment.
Okay.
I'd always, when I worked in my restaurant, at my dad's restaurant, although I worked as a busboy, washed dishes, I was the co-owner's son, and I knew I didn't have to bus dishes for all my life to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
When I got into the Navy, this is my first experience of people who, all different stratas of society, and as a footnote, I think one of the things we've lost now as a nation with the ending of the draft, and I understand why and support it, but one of the things that the service did with the draft is all different people from many walks of life were put together in small spaces and associated in grew generally by working, living, laughing, and maybe arguing or mm-hmm. more with people of different types, look different. I had 30-some guys working for me, split between gunner's mates and fire control technicians. The gunner's mates were people that were good mechanically, and they were smarter than the bosun mates, who generally were the people that you had resigned or gave to chip paint and where everyone started out. But they were mechanical. They were probably guys working cars today. And the fire control technicians were a blend of people who do radar as well as computers. We had a big electromechanical computer, probably the size of a desk, that we used to use to calculate firing solutions for either anti-air or anti-surface.
Okay.
And I had two chiefs when I came on board. One was a guy named Fry. He was promoted to E8 when I was second cruise, and he was as sly as a fox. He was quiet, but he was probably in his own way brilliant. And I didn't really appreciate him until the second cruise, but he was an example. The radio chief one time lost the combination to his safe.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked Chief Fry to pick the safe for him, and Chief Fry did.
Right.
Fry one time did a overhaul of this mechanical computer, this big Hummer, at sea, when it was something that was done only in a shipyard. But he was just quite a guy. And the funny thing about it, one time between the first and second cruise, we went out for one day for a fast run, test some engineering equipment, and Chief Fry's family was on the pier crying and hugging him and everything else, and we were formed up on the fantail, and I said, Chief, why are they crying? And he looked turned to me and said, they think we're deploying. So he basically told them a month before we left that we had left.
Mm-hmm.
So that he would go ashore every night when he didn't have the duty for the next month, have fun in town.
Right.
And so just a sly guy. I had another guy named Chief Convoy, who was an interesting character. He was married to a Japanese who lived in Japan. He was a recovered alcoholic, and he really liked to be at sea. He was nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. Just a real nervous guy. He is confident, but just really high-strung. And he always preferred to be at sea, and he would always swap to go on ships that were going to be on Westpac, in Westpac. So I got him as we were going the first time, because my chief wanted to stay in San Diego. Convoy found out that we were going to Westpac, swapped, and when we were coming back, he swapped again. So I didn't get to use him much, but just an interesting character. I still remember when we were off of Korea one night, and he was listening to the Army-Navy game on the fantail, and so it really struck me how he and the other chiefs really adopted the Naval Academy as their university, their football school, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and here was a guy who we were 9,000 miles away and found through Armed Forces Radio or shortwave a way to listen to the Army-Navy game.
Mm, right.
The other chief I had was McPherson, who took Convoy's job, and he just a real brilliant guy, probably a young John Wayne, if you will, part Cherokee, and just really a very effective guy.
Mm-hmm.
But going generally to the crew, we had the captain, who was named Taylor, Frank Taylor, and then he was relieved by Walt Tolkey. And very experienced, Taylor was extremely experienced ship handler, maybe one of the best, I think, in the fleet. A real quiet guy. Ran a pretty good ship, but he had bad luck. We had an executive officer who was lieutenant commander. The CO was a commander. XO was lieutenant commander. And the department heads, of which there were four, were lieutenants. And then we had JGs and ensigns as junior officers.
Okay.
About 20 chiefs, as I said, and they would be between 35 and 48-ish. And then we had the mass of people. Most of the crew was under 20 years old. I think you had to be 17 with parents' permission to enlist. I wouldn't be surprised if we had one or two 16-year-olds.
Mm, right.
But the crew was really a mix of people. We had one of the guys in my division was a person, FTG 3, third class, Petty Officer Third Class Weed, who was had the same degree I did, or went in political science, didn't like the war, and he would challenge the challenge me on why we're here, is the war winnable, things like that, and I was not interested in debating the merits of the war because clearly I was didn't matter what I thought is what we were going to do.
Right, right.
We had people. I had a petty officer, third class, who was my age, 22, and he was on his third wife. And he was from East Tennessee, which I later found out where my kin's from. And he was a good guy, fairly good, but he would do silly things sometimes, or things not. He lost one of the digits on his. One of his fingers one time because he didn't put the magazine in, or the hoist as he was doing preventive maintenance. He didn't put it in safety and it cycled and it cut off a part of one of his fingers.
Oh.
Just stuff like that.
Right.
But Hoover, the first cruise I got on, I started getting all these letters from the XO. They're Dunny letters on Hoover, and you don't like the captain is always some of the good guy. The XO is the guy who cracks the whip on a ship, executive officer.
Okay.
And I finally went to Hoover and said, Hoover, what are all these letters Dunning you basically want? They want to, you're not paying your bills. And what's wrong? Because he said, my wife, that bitch. And evidently, Hoover and his wife had a disagreement. She was 16 or 17.
Uh-huh.
They had a fight, so she went and took his credit card, where it was, and bought major appliances for all of her family and friends.
Right.
And he said, I'm not going to pay for those. And I said, okay. Did you give her your credit card? Yes. Do you remember signing a power of attorney? And he said, what's that? And do you remember signing a letter giving her the power to sign contracts? And he said, yes. Okay, well, I said, Hoover, I don't think you can have any, you've got to pay the bills because she had the right to do what she did, so, that bitch. And so we fast forward, we come back from first deployment, and Hoover takes leave right away and goes back to East Tennessee and comes back 3 weeks later and all smiling faces. Well, I said, well, how'd it go? And he said, well, that's fine. Well, we had a good time. And, My in-laws picked me up, and they had their pickup with the shell on the back and a mattress there, so they put my wife and I back in there, and we screwed as they took us home. And I thought, you did what? In-laws? Anyway, so what I found in the crew was this wide variety of people. There's one guy who was a seaman from Wyoming, I would call him a mean drunk. I kept getting these shore patrol reports I'd get them about 3 weeks out from every port, and it turns out he would get drunk at every port and pick a fight with shore patrol, which is not a good thing to do.
Right.
And I kept trying, and I learned then to use enlisted structure. So I found one of my good second class. His name was Bush. I said, Bush, why don't you take this guy in your wing and fix him? Just fix him. He came. And so Bush is from Alaska, great guy, an FTG, came back at 3 weeks and said, Mr. Modern, I've got a problem. I can't fix him. I said, why? He said, what do you do with a guy that just wants to be a cowboy?
Right.
So and he was right. If all he wanted to do was raise cattle and livestock, he didn't care. And so I learned quickly that people have different aspirations, different backgrounds, and different plans for their future.
Right.
Going back to the crew in general, there were certainly distinct groups of aptitudes and affinities. The people in the damage control technicians, be welders and pipe fitters, those guys were excellent in terms of fixing things. They'd be the people repairing all the urinals and overhead lights and captain's air conditioner when I shot four gun salvos.
Right.
The deck people would always be young and or I'd say they had a attitude problem or basically an aptitude problem or didn't give a rat's ass.
Mm-hmm.
One guy who's a big strapping guy, probably 18, 19, was from New York. We were in San Francisco, and he came back from my quarters one day, and he had his whole side of his face was just all puffed up. He said, "What happened? What happened?" He said, "Well, I found this lady in a bar, and we went out, and I was going back to her place, and three guys jumped me. Basically, with a setup, they were going to roll the sailor,
right?
And they were going to take my wallet, and I started getting the best of them, and she hit me with her purse. I said, well, and I did that. He said, well, she had a brick in her purse.
Oh, ouch.
And so you had the deck division would be people who were new seamen that didn't go to a specialty school and would try to get up to a what we called strike or basically apprentice into technician or yeoman or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had the gunner's mates and the FTGs who were the same division. You had the people who were snipes, which would be the damage control people, and the people who lived in the boiler room and the engine room. Probably the most most thankless job, it'd be 120, 125 down in the boiler rooms when we were off the gun line.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be 110, 105, 108 or so. Now, there's not much difference, 105, 110 with humidity, but you go down to the boiler room, you get to 120 degrees. It would be, they all were skinny, and they always had oily bodies because we burned fuel oil, and they were a very crucial part of a ship.
Right.
As you went up in the superstructure of the ship, you got into the electronic technicians, the people who repaired the radio gear, the tube gear. There's nothing that was chip-based. It was all tube. And so the intelligence and the aptitude went up. Then you get into the operational people, like the navigation and people who did maneuvering board, the singlemen. These people not only were smart, but they were quick. They were quick to analyze, quick to make decisions. And so you had people who had different mechanical or work aptitudes, and then you had certainly cognitive abilities that were different.
Mm-hmm.
But the ship was when you are deployed for 6 months and you're at sea for 4 to 6 weeks at a time, the ship that becomes a community. It's a living community where people know each other, And I do not know of any fight between crew members for either deployment on the ship.
Mm, okay.
Now, it was sometimes you'd have fights with that dumbass ship over there,
mm-hmm.
or those blicky blank Marines.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was in Cuba, the Marines always picked fights on the Coast Guard. For some reason, they didn't like white ships. And they would, I'm meandering here, but they would get the smallest guy in their battalion, try to pick a fight with the biggest coastie.
And right.
As soon as the coastie would rise the cage, and the whole bar would stand up, and they'd just break it down.
Uh-huh.
It was like a scene out of a Wild West.
Right.
But the crew, overall, you had older guys who'd be the department heads, COXO, and chiefs, and you had the JOs who had limited experience, but they had college educations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, which of the 18-20 officers probably had 6 or 7 from the academy, and then you had the petty officers, and then the non-rated people, the mm-hmm. E3s, E2, E3s.
All right.
Does that give you the information you wanted?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, overall, how was morale on the ship, would you say?
I thought morale was pretty good.
All right.
We usually would have reenlistment, especially when the second tour, when the bonuses went up and people would reenlist in the war zone, which means they didn't have to pay taxes.
Okay.
People didn't like getting seasick. They didn't like... The ship was old and battered and beat up and didn't. It was not a nice place to live. But what struck me is how people acclimate. I mean, you eventually acclimate to your surroundings. Most people. And I think morale was probably on a scale of 1 to 10, probably a 6 or 7, depends on if you're Hoover and his wife was out buying refrigerators for her friends.
Right.
Or if you were the seaman who was, you know, he was probably happy when he was drunk, I don't know. But guys were generally okay.
Mm-hmm.
Those that had wives and close family members, such as parents or fiance, for example,
mm-hmm.
really were torn by the separation, because we would be underway away from our home port 6 months of the year, and when we were in port the 6 months, we would really be at sea for 2 or 3 months of those 6 months.
Okay.
So one of the things that struck me, and I was single at the time, was how hard it was for people, would be for people, to have a marriage that was based on seeing each other, the husband and wife, frequently. I mean, it literally, the same goes, the wife raised the children,
mm-hmm.
and the husband sent the check, direct deposit.
Right.
And I think that was probably the biggest traction for morale. In terms of the war, and whether it's right or wrong, I think other than a few people who had voiced opinions, we all were there. We knew we were, I mean, there was no option of going anywhere else. And so you whatever you people thought, and Weed was a guy who voiced, thought the war was dumb.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't go AWOL. So I think separation from loved family and dear friends and maybe personal circumstances were the most negative factor on morale. That's my opinion, thinking back.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. once you joined the ship, was it too long after that did you guys go directly, sail directly to Vietnam at that point? Or?
Yeah, we left 3 or 4 weeks after I joined. So.
Okay.
So I'm basically 3 weeks from college to join the ship, which is like the 21st, let's say, of June, and mid-July, we deploy.
Okay.
You'd asked me a question earlier about how my ROTC training helped me, prepared me.
Right.
It didn't.
Okay.
So I went for 6 weeks, probably 2 months after graduation and commissioning. I was at sea heading for Vietnam.
Right.
And I had missed refresher training, which was a whole ship team training, damage control, gunnery, everything else. So I really fell in a crack of no training. So I was immersed in a do or die or do or get screamed at situation. My department head was a Naval Academy graduate, 3 years. He was a class, I think, of 67. Brilliant guy, abysmal people skills. And so I was basically in the boiling water to learn how to operate the guns, learn how to do maneuvering to get up to the expertise of the Naval Academy graduates. And so I was just, I was immersed in training myself, and I was at an extremely steep learning curve. Some of the silly things going on with people. And one of the things I didn't mention to you is when you're at sea, at least we were at sea, everyone operates with medium sleep deprivation.
Okay.
In the sense that you are standing watches, 4 on, 8 off. And there's a dog watch, which is the afternoon watch between, watches rotate. So your body can never adjust to when it's going to get deep sleep, and you do your normal job during the underway time. So that stand watches probably 10 to 12 hours a day and work 6 to 8, depending on the day, Monday through Sunday. It was, we sometimes took, we didn't do work center activity, didn't do maintenance on Sundays.
Okay.
But so we'd all be fatigued, really deprived of sleep, and it would be like a low grade flu. You medicated yourself with caffeine.
Right.
There'd be guys that would drink 8 to 10 cups of coffee a day.
Wow.
Every work center, and I had one I had with Gunner's Mates where had a coffee maker. And so everyone had a special brew. They put a little salt in the coffee, or they put some sugar in it. And some people who were really drank a lot of coffee supposedly could tell where the coffee came from. What
right.
I ended up finding Coca-Cola was really good. I would drink. We had second cruise. Our captain put in a Coke machine. And so instead of when you get up for midnight watch, the mid-watch, instead of having a hot cup of coffee, I thought it was a cold Coke gave me more refreshment, and I got the same caffeine kick.
Right.
The attribute, or this caused me to really learn how to sleep efficiently, which when you think about sleep, deep sleep is real important for clearing your brain and mental health.
Right.
So if you think about pictures of World War II, you will often see pictures of sailors, especially in the Pacific, of sleeping in improbable positions.
Right.
I learned to sleep quickly. In fact, my wife complains that she I can go to sleep from when she turns off the light on a wall socket or wall switch and gets to bed, I'll be asleep.
Right.
I learned to sleep like that, or my stateroom forward broom closet was between the two gun mounts at one deck below, and I'd be able to sleep during gunfire.
Wow.
So one of the things that we operated, one of the things I learned about was how to be efficient in sleep, how to be efficient in time, and everyone else probably had that same need.
Right. All right. Let's see. Well, once the Agra home set sail, how long did it take to get from San Diego to the coast of off the coast of Vietnam?
About a month.
About a month. Okay.
Basically, went the first time. It took 4 weeks. Second time, it took about 2.5 weeks because we were replacing a ship that had a mechanical problem. But we went the first time. We went San Diego to Pearl. Spent 3 days in Pearl, which was nice, and then went from Pearl to Midway. And Midway Island's really cool.
Hmm.
It is a real isolated atoll. It's the end of the Hawaiian Island chain.
Okay.
And it was very historic. We still see World War II wreckage around. There's some murals from the Midway battle.
Mm,
a lot
right.
of goonie birds. And these are protected albatrosses, birds. And we were all informed that, especially during nesting season, you touch any one of them, it's disturbed them, it's a federal offense because they're protected species.
Mm-hmm.
But we do usually pull in there to get refueled and go on to Guam. And the Guam to the midway to Guam was about a 11-day trip, and then from Guam to Subic Bay in the Philippines, where we would get our 50 calibers and load up any other special munitions we needed to do, and then it'd take about 6 days to go from Subic to wherever you're going to do on Vietnam. So total time the first time was close to a month. We did it in about 2.5 weeks the second time.
Okay.
We didn't go through Midway the second time. And we just went right from Pearl to Apri Harbor, refueled, and went into right into Subic. Apri Harbor was always just a pit stop, basically 6 hours to get fuel and water. We always had to get water and whatever foodstuffs we needed. Navy destroyers at that time, basically, depending on the speed they were operating at, if they were operating at 18 knots or below, probably could go 7-8 days without refueling. If they operated at 22, 24 knots or above, as we did when we were on Yankee Station, would probably need to be refueled every 3 days. And wouldn't be that we'd run out. Is you'd have to. There was a critical point where you need to have there's a wartime reserve, and I don't know if that was 40% of capacity, whatever. But we always managed to have in the top 60% and kept the 40% as a wartime reserve for contingencies.
Okay.
So it took us. Your question took us the first time about 4 weeks to get to.
Mm-hmm. All right. And once you guys arrived there, how much did the atmosphere change aboard ship?
Well, it changed in several ways, fairly in some subtle, some not.
Okay.
The weather increasingly became hotter. And more humid. And if you're over there in monsoon season in the Philippines, some of these rains, you get 3 or 4 inches an hour, and you wouldn't be able to see barely 100 yards, sometimes 50 yards.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In Vietnam, it would be this impressive heat, just really impressive heat. If you touch certain metals, you might burn your hand.
Mm, right.
It was so hot. So the weather was something that changed. Also, when you entered the combat zone, taxes went away. That was a happy thing.
Right.
And you could get free postage by just signing your name. But what happened when we went from when we went to Hawaii, going retracing the trip,
mm-hmm.
that was a little festive because of Waikiki, or one like to spend the day at Waikiki or a night at one of the bars or whatever. But as we get closer to Subic was the wartime port, it was the largest naval base in the world outside of the United States. So it was third largest outside of Norfolk in San Diego, and that was where people were refueling, rearming, doing R&R. As you got, as then went to Vietnam, depending on your assignment, the focus on what you were going to do, the briefings that you either gave or attended, became more serious, more focused on what's going on with the operations, what's the operations order, what's the comm plan, that type of thing, communications plan.
Okay.
So you would go from a military organization that is training for war or combat operations to one that is entering combat operations, and things became more serious.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Oh, one question I meant to ask you about the trip over to Vietnam, about the journey over. Did you guys have a crossing the international dateline ceremony of sorts?
No, we didn't.
Okay.
We would go over with our squadron, and it would be, these were working destroyers, so we didn't. Pass it, and it'd be in the plan of the day, POD. We pass it, and people say, okay, change the clocks. So it was really mechanical. You kept changing the clocks, and you changed the day, and it was really not an event, not like going across the equator.
Okay, right.
One of the times, though, we had two memories of crossing Westpac going west. Is first time, we had a destroyer escort with us, a Knox class. It was one of McNamara's programs that basically was evidently initially designed as a very effective destroyer. And to take money out, they made it from the two-screw ship to a single-screw ship. And those ships always broke down, or frequently broke down. So one of our five ships was this DE, and someone had to tow it into Guam, which is sort of not good. The call sign was Husky Pup, and sometimes at night when the officers or when the CO was not around, some of the enlisted guys would call it Hush Puppy on the radio nets, and they would come back and say, well, this is Husky Pup, not Hush Puppy.
Right.
We had one guy one time, and we were in a, I still remember, we were in a column abreast. We were about a mile apart, and someone on one of the other ships had turned himself into the XO, saying that he was gay.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant at the time that you would. That you would be mustered out of service.
Mm-hmm.
We muttered, and it wasn't just the officers, it was the enlisted crew that I knew about, that it was the guy probably just trying to get out of the war.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Three nights later, or three mornings later, he was missing at sea.
Mm.
And it apparently somebody had given him a blanket party, which is the colloquial term for put the blanket over his head, hit him alongside the head, and thrown overboard during the night. And the formation had traveled 8 hours.
Right.
And we didn't turn back. It determined that he probably was, by that time he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
The ships just, we had assignments to be where we had to be for some operations and didn't have time to spare.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one memory I have across and over. Another is that second time I went over, we were with another squadron, and the squadron commander evidently was a bit he likes pomp and circumstances, I guess. So he said on Sundays during daytime that we were to wear dress uniforms. So here we are. The closest ship is a mile away. There's one on the port, one on the starboard, and you go up the bridge, and people are wearing whites.
Right.
And was that stupid or what? That was my first experience with a stupid command.
Right.
So, which you're going to do it, and it was just like, why? I mean, because you go out and work, and when you get salt water spray, and you got grease all around, it just didn't make, just did not make sense. That's why khakis were really good for the officers.
Right.
I don't know if I may have gone off your question. So.
No, not at all. Not at all.
That's the type of thing you're interested in?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. Well, I guess the next question I have for you then is if you talk a little more in detail about your own specific assignment and how your assignment was in the war zone.
Okay. At this time, it probably had been from, like, probably from 67, certainly through 72, 73, when Vietnam ended. Destroyers really had several assignments. They were either gunfire support, called NGFS, Naval Gunfire Support, or it would be screening duties for carriers or around carrier flight operations.
Okay.
So my duties varied based on what the ship was assigned.
Okay.
If we were on Yankee Station, we would be around a carrier, and we call them bird farms.
All right.
And we'd either be screening, like, port or starboard. And the carriers would be always faster. The carriers would always be chasing the wind because they wanted to have 30, 40 miles an hour knots of wind across the deck to launch. And if there's no wind, they would have to go 30 knots. And so they would have these carriers sprinting back and forth and the destroyers trying to keep up with them.
Mm-hmm.
We could, but... going back to the previous comment, if we were at 20 plus knots, our fuel usage really went up. And if you're going 20, 24 knots, and we could go up to about 30, things really started shaking. But we'd have to refuel every 3 days, which became inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
So on Yankee Station, we'd be assigned to a carrier, we'd be screening, or we'd be on plane guard. In plane guard, there are two plane guard stations. One was 1,200 to 1,700 yards astern of the carrier at 185 degrees relative, basically lining up where the angle deck is, where the landing deck is on a carrier.
Okay.
And we were there in case somebody fell overboard, a plane had a ditch to pick up the crew, as well as a reference point for the landing, for the pilots who are landing.
Okay.
There was another plane guard station that was 3 to 5 miles aft of the carrier. And this is where the corkscrew down, where the squadrons coming back would go through their descending altitudes around the destroyer that'd be 3 to 5 miles back.
Okay.
So when I was at, when we were on Yankee Station, my job on watches was changing station, maintaining, because the carrier would change direction and change speed based on what they needed to launch. Sometimes they'd tell you and sometimes they didn't. If you were right behind the carrier, 12 to 1,700 yards, you had to be very watchful what the carrier did. One night we were in the Sea of Japan behind the Midway and they lost load, which is they lost electrical and they just went whack. We were going about 20, we were going about 18 knots and we were probably about 1,500 yards, and we got to 600 yards pretty quickly. And that's when you really get puckered.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because, a destroyer hitting a carrier would probably take the paint off the carrier and sink the carrier, sink the destroyer.
Right, right.
So my watch, as an officer, you really have two sets of duties that are interwoven because they conflict for time. One is what you do in the watches, and then what you do for your specialty. My specialty was gunnery, and we were in Yankee Station. We just do maintenance and checks, but I was really focused on either bridge watches or combat information center, breaking down signals, changing course, what they want us to do. And we always had to be alert for the Russian. There was usually a Russian spy ship or a missile cruiser in the vicinity of the Yankee Station.
Okay.
They were there to report any raids, any launches, and they were probably there to, in case of a hot war, to shoot a missile at the carrier. And there usually be 2 to 4 carriers on Yankee Station.
Mm-hmm.
There were two. There was a Yankee Station and Dixie Station. Dixie Station, when I was there, in 70 was not being used. They decided to put everyone together on Yankee Station for reasons I've never thought of.
Okay.
So related to Yankee Station were two other destroyer assignments. One was SAR, it'd be North SAR, Search and Rescue, and then PIRAS, Positive Identification Radiation, was what we did. So SAR is you'd be up close to North Vietnam, and you'd be where the pilots that were damaged over on raids North Vietnam would try to get to so they could be saved.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we would be 60 to 90 miles away from the Yankee Station, and that was our assignment then.
Okay.
Can you call me back in a second?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, patience.
Sure, not a problem.
So, you'd asked me what my duties were, and I was talking about, I divided them into Yankee Station, which is really working around the carriers, and
mm-hmm.
then I'll do gunfire support in a few minutes.
Okay.
So, Yankee Station, we'd be screening or in clearing guard, which
mm-hmm.
would be protecting or in some way being involved with the carrier. There was SAR, which would be up, you'd be up away from the carrier group, close to a bingo, which is a punch-out area for the pilots.
Okay.
Or you'd be in PIRAS, and PIRAS was important. We'd be with a missile ship, and sometimes it'd be a double-ender, which means missiles fore and aft. And we'd be there as protection on the missile ship in case NVA gunboats would come out and attack, because the missile ships did not have any surface guns.
Okay.
And PIRAS was a positive identification radiation area where planes returning from raids had to be positively identified before they were allowed to land.
Okay.
And so that was important. So it was usually 90 to 120 miles away. We had cap over us in both SAR and PIRAS. Two memories I have of working with the carriers is clearly plane guard. When you were behind the carrier, you had to be very alert what the carrier was doing. When we were in the distant plane guard, the 3 to 7 miles, the first tour we had, I think it was the first tour, we had a fighter, a Corsair, I think, lose power, and it came through 3 or 4 levels of the spiral and hit a E-2A, knocked 5 feet off the wing, and the E-2A crashed just instantly. I was on watch, but it happened so fast, I was looking off the starboard wings, happened off the port bow, and six guys on the crew basically were dead. And this was their last mission before going home.
Oh, no.
And we were in a small boat in the water for the next 2 or 3 hours picking up remnants of bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I learned then that brains and intestines don't have any color.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just really a sad thing to put remains, fragments of helmets and brains in plastic bags and try to honor the people that had just died so tragically but suddenly.
Right, right.
One of our SAR events, this is probably in hindsight, I don't know, we were given one mission one day to go up real close to North Vietnam. I don't know why, but I remember we were all with General Quarters, and we went up, we probably it was real flat. We probably could basically, well, we see fishing pots. Anytime you see fishing pot markers, you know you're in shallow water.
Mm-hmm.
And the screws were turning up mud from the bottom, so we knew we were not, we drew 26 feet. So we probably were in fairly shallow water, and we did what we needed to do. We turned around and went as fast as we could go to get out of the area.
Mm-hmm.
One of the PIRAS experiences was we were on Yankee Station, and Stars and Stripes said we had, I remember reading Stars and Stripes, said the helo dropped over, and they said there were two carriers on Yankee Station. I looked out and there were five, so I said, well, the reporter obviously has got it wrong. Three or four days later, we were put up on North, we were put up on PIRAS, and a helo came over the horizon. They usually, they flew fairly close to, they're flying fairly close to the surface, and they dropped on the cruiser, and about an hour later, we were given orders to come alongside, and a message tube was passed to the bridge, and it turned out 2 days later, or actually it was that night, we went to General Quarters Surprise at 2 a.m., and it was a Song Tay prisoner of war raid.
Mm, okay.
And we were actually on the outside of Haiphong Harbor at the time, and for to pick up any pilots that were shot, that may have been shot down. There were none shot down. But the guys in combat said that there were so many planes in the air, the air search radar was just all white from all the contacts. There are probably several, at least my FTG, who was in combat, said there were, looked like there were about 1,000 planes in the air.
Mm, wow.
Some, apparently, according to him, they went over into north into China, based on where we had the Chinese North Vietnam border.
Okay.
So that was quite a, anytime you go to general quarters, especially at night when it's unplanned, you really pucker up. And
right.
That was one of my memories from that that experience. And that, so that was when you're with a carrier, which is what destroyers are really designed to do, you really operate to the carrier. Frequently going back, again, going back to Yankee Station operations, whenever the carrier was refueling and rearming from a supply ship, the Russians always tried to put themselves in a position where the carrier would be going, because if you put a supply ship alongside a ship getting replenished, either oil or munitions or food or whatever,
mm-hmm.
they will take a course that is favorable to seas and wind and stay on that course going probably 9 to 12 knots until the replenishment's finished. What the Russians would do would be race around to put themselves in a on a course in speed to have a collision and try to break up the replenishment.
Mm-hmm.
So they were doing this harassment all the time, and it was really annoying because you'd basically what would take normally 2 hours, you'd have to do it twice, and it was really, it didn't mean you just got less sleep.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that was that's experience on the carrier operations. Any questions before I go to gunfire?
Yeah, a few about the Song Tay raid, if you don't mind.
Sure.
At what point did you guys realize what was going on? Did you know about the raid itself?
We didn't know anything about the raid itself.
Okay.
Evidently, the orders were carried over by courier. There was no electronic communication of the orders. It was all personal courier from D.C. on an airplane to Yankee Station.
Mm-hmm.
Although clearly the carriers were assigned, were directed, but there was no apparently. People weren't told you're going there because we're going to do a big raid on the POW camps.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really understand what had happened until the day after or several days after when we received a report that they did not find the POWs.
Mm-hmm.
We were just my FTG3, and I still talk to him periodically. See him. He lives in San Francisco. we didn't know what was going on. But anytime you have 1,000 planes and all of a sudden you realize you're up at the northern part of the Gulf, this is not good. Again, you're in a World War II destroyer with 4 or 5-inch guns that are mounted forward, nothing aft in case you have to run, in a ship that someone can punch through with a ball-peen hammer.
Right.
This is all of a sudden you're saying, this is serious.
Right.
So we did not know, and it was clear though that when it was going on, it was pucker time. I think certainly the operations officer and a few other and the department heads on the ship were briefed. The JO, I wasn't. They followed directives. Directives were to hold all information extremely close, and they did.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
And even for us, we had no way to communicate to anyone. We didn't have any, then you didn't have cell phones, when you were at sea then, you would really be isolated from anything except mail that came periodically by helo, or sometimes if you were close to Saigon, you get Armed Forces Network.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. One other question about these types of missions. When you would come, when the Agra Home would come close to the North Vietnamese shore, did you guys ever receive any opposition?
No, we didn't. Although I didn't know, my hunch is that we had cap over us, and I think that one time, when we went up north, we were used as bait.
Okay.
And the North Vietnamese did not rise to the occasion. That's the only reason why we go north. We that far north, that shallow water. We didn't have electronic gear that would be sophisticated enough, in my opinion, to listen in on something.
Mm-hmm.
Although that could have been moving 30 hours north to get closer radio reception just did not make sense. So my sense was we were probably bait at the time.
Right.
Or they wanted us to visually look at something. It could have been, also could have been testing when the Vietnamese, North Vietnam, would identify us.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we left quickly. We left as quickly as we could go.
Okay.
So that's just my opinion, and I don't have more information.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. All right.
So anything else to carry before I go to gun line?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Reflecting again, when you're around a carrier, you are really focused on everything centers around the flight operations, which were the strike missions and then the return of the strikes, and the carrier's running for wind, and you basically involved with that whole activity, and you'd be anywhere from 1,200 yards to 90 miles from the carrier, as I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The other role, which changed my activity, was when we were on gunfire support off Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
We call it NGFS, Naval Gunfire Support.
Okay.
And that's where I had all the fun. Basically, we carried 4 5-inch 38 guns. The Army would call them, Army and Marines would call them 127 millimeter guns, and they were two twin mounts forwards. We could fire 15 rounds continuous over long times. You could do 22 rounds, this is per barrel, on rapid fire for maybe 5 to 10 minutes.
Okay.
So 15 rounds per mount, that's 30 rounds a minute. That's pretty impressive. We would typically fire 12 to 1,300 rounds per deployment.
Okay.
We we would be anywhere from a half mile to 1 mile offshore. The range of the 5-inch gun was about 17,500 yards. Standard projectile. We had a rocket-assisted projectile called RAP, which was really cool. We get about 23,000, 24,000 yards, although the RAP projectile had less explosive and it was not as accurate because you get farther out.
Mm-hmm.
The shell, 5-inch shell, weighed 58 pounds, and it had about 17, 18 pounds of explosive. There were several ammunition types
okay. That
we'd use depending on what the assignment was. Most of the assignments were troops in the open, and so we'd use AAC, which is Able Common, which was a time fuse. Basically, the computer, the gunfire computer I mentioned earlier, the Chief Fry repaired once, we would set AAC, which was also an anti-aircraft round, to go off about 30 yards height before it would height and just basically shoot fragments like a big hand grenade in the air.
Okay.
We also used VT frag. It had a little proximity fuse that would go off when it detected a body, and that was something developed World War II for kamikaze, so it wouldn't go off until it got close to a target. In our case, we use it, and it'd go off about 30 feet instead of 30 yards over the ground.
Mm-hmm.
They were more expensive, so we preferred AAC. We had a semi-armored piercing called High Cap. We'd use that against bunkers.
Okay.
Willie Peter, which was white phosphorus. We'd use that for special targets. White phosphorus is really, really, really nasty.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mineral. It's a mineral that, when it's exposed to oxygen, burns until it's consumed.
Right.
So it's used for spotting or used if you want to do something really nasty about people.
Mm-hmm.
Star shells, and I mentioned about RAP.
Right.
So we would go typically either to 2 Corps and Jason, you might know. I think you probably know that Vietnam was organized by corps areas.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We were typically in 2 Corps or Runsat Special Zone. The Runsat Special Zone is down by the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our first mission was when I went over was I guess we went to Phan Thiet.
Okay.
In 2 Corps, and we would basically be in two watch sections, blue and gold, which means you'd be 4 on, 4 off.
Okay.
You'd be going 3-5 knots offshore, and you'd wait for spotters to come up, and it'd either be air spotters from the Army or ground spotters that give you targets. And sometimes at night we'd call H&A, harassment and interdiction fire, which you'd randomly shoot a shell in a certain area. We always thought we were being harassed more than the people we were shooting at.
Right.
It would, you know, wake the crews up. But depending on the activity, we'd fire, usually you get a target, you'd fire one shot, he'd adjust, you'd fire a second shot, and then he'd ask for fire for effect, 10 rounds, and you'd pump out 5 rounds a barrel, something like that, and be done with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that'd go on and on. One of the things I remember is that the first deployment, there was a problem with projectiles exploding in barrels, which is not a good thing.
Right.
And there were a couple gun crews that were lost and other destroyers. It turns out, after analysis, that some of the ammunition was old World War II, old Korean War, or reworked World War II shells. And I may be wrong about World War II shells. They had at the base of the shell, there was a seal that when the powder was ignited in the gun chamber, protected the mechanism on the base of the shell. The fuse of the shell is in the base. This is a gas seal, and they thought there was a defective gas seal causing the donation of the powder to ignite the shell, which is not a good thing.
So we
had to go through and inventory and look at every single shell. We had about 14. We used to carry about 1,400 rounds.
Right.
That was something I always had to do. We did once or twice, and then they were trying to work through what the problem was. And then I remembered that, and I'm still doing it today. I had to do a tag for every single empty powder canister.
Okay.
Now, the Navy uses Navy destroyer 5-inch 38 caliber guns. It's semi-fixed. Basically, you have a projectile, and then you have a 34-pound powder charge that's ignited, and the shell is ejected from the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
Powder is either, there are three types, flashless, non-flashless, depends on night or day, and then there's a short round, which is used to lob a shell over a hill.
Okay.
Well, I had to, because some doofus on some other ship had mixed live powder with empty canisters, and there was an explosion somewhere. I had, there was a directive that came out that all gunnery officers had to personally inventory all the empty powder casings and sign a tag. So I used to write in high school, Jim Modern, and it was in ROT, James W. Modern. And I started doing that the first 50 or 80 shell casings. And then I got to J.W. Modern, and finally got to J.W.M. You know, after you're doing 1,000 of these,
right?
you start to abbreviate, but still had to meet the letter of the law. So I'd be up to my, they'd be piles of these canisters, waist deep. And when you're shooting 500 a day or something like that, you'd sort of go through them fairly fast.
Right.
So the these missions would either be fire, you know, you get a target, and you'd have your bridge watch would be conning the ship. Combat would be taking the communications from the spotter, and then you'd have the gun plot, which would be setting the speed of the ship. You put the barometric pressure. You put the temperature of the fire, the magazines. All this went in the computer, and then the gun crews would be operating the guns. Naval gunfire is extremely accurate. But another characteristic is the trajectory is very flat because it has a very high muzzle velocity.
Okay.
The bullet goes very straight, so we'd be very good for targets we could see or reach, but it'd be more difficult if you had to shoot to the backside of a mountain, which is why we had short charges.
Mm, right.
We used targets. We used spotters. We had the second tour. We had something interesting. The Army became involved with sensors, and basically we reported on back at Antietam, second deployment, and a briefing, Army briefing came on board, and they told us about these sensors. Basically, they were sensors down a supply pass, and they were nothing more than remote radios, and they would be triggered when somebody was going down a path, if you will, and they kick off, and you'd track them. Here's device one, here's device two. And so we knew when we heard these, we said, okay, here's where these devices are planted.
Right.
And we hear when they get to this device, we're going to fire three rounds here, and they're going to just try to escape up this ravine. We're going to put a round over there. And so we fired a couple missions that that were basically remote like that without any spotter at night. It was quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because you would not have any visibility, any eyeball identification of a target. It was all all mechanical, and it was all remote, and they'd go, the spotters would go over the next day and see if they could find any bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Not my ship, but a ship before us, I think it was before us, was on a similar mission, and evidently there was two VC, or NVA, that were having sex near one of the recorders.
Okay.
And so the ship really had a fun time combat listening to the moaning and groaning of the couple having sex.
Right.
So that was one of the amusing things. Another mission we had was at Runsat Special Zone, and this is I think the first deployment, and we get an army briefing on board. They had a battalion of Cambodians. And Cambodia at this time, with Prince Sihanouk, was neutral.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And all of a sudden, they come in and brief and say, we're training a battalion of Cambodians. This is top secret. So, okay. And they said that this is a formation that's very tenuous. If they get attacked, we're concerned they're just going to scatter like geese.
Mm-hmm.
So your job is, you're here to protect them for gunfire support, so we're going to call on, so you basically tell us protocols and the fact we need to be really alert for a call, to response to a mission within 2 or 3 minutes of getting the call.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time I started to suspect that everything I'd been reading in the U.S. papers was not exactly as it was, because here is, number one, a secret training mission, and secondly, this ally of the troops would break and run at sound of a firecracker.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something else I remember.
Right.
So we would do these. Most of my time was gunfire support, and we would fire 1,200 to 1,300 rounds per deployment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is really, we'd be on gun line for about a month at a time.
Okay.
And depending on your rate of fire, you would have to go out and replenish. There was coming from Subic, a day apart would be a supply ship. So in a clockwise fashion, starting from the south, going towards I Corps and around, were supply ships. So if you were running out of shells or fuel, we only need to refuel. Since we're going slow, then we don't really need to refuel maybe every 7 to 10 days.
Okay.
But we'd have to rearm every 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
You would basically determine where the next refueling, rearming that ship was. It'd be about 100 miles offshore. You'd race out and pick and rendezvous with them, go alongside, replenish, and then break off and race back to your gunfire support station.
Mm-hmm.
And when we rearmed like that, it would be an all hands evolution, and every guy would these shells would come over in pallets of 48, and it would take every person would have a round and carry them up to the magazine hoist, which were up forward, and they'd be cycled down mechanically to the lower magazine. So
Okay. Each
one of these shells were identified, serial number. Because again, we had exploding shells because of old projectiles and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it was very routine. When we go out, it'd be you'd often get ice. Sometimes get ice cream. You'd certainly get movies. Movies is always, you'd always barter for movies. And one of the favorite ones I remember, we got inadvertently, somehow through the sensors, there was a movie called Vampire Lovers or something like that.
Okay.
And this turned out to have nude scenes.
Uh-huh.
And that, all of a sudden, that was an instant hit. We were showing that one Sunday in the wardroom, and all of a sudden these nude scenes come up, which was completely unheard of.
Right.
And we were 3 weeks out from any report or anything, and all of a sudden there were guys in the gangway enlisted trying to peer and everything else, and they said, hey, hurry up and get that done so we can see in the mess decks. But it was quite surprising. I still remember I think it was Vampire Lovers, but it was really a stupid movie, but they had tips.
Right. Right.
Now, another memorandum going, I'll go back and forth here.
Okay.
One of the good entertainment memories I have is a somewhat equivalent experience. Bob Hope was on one of the carriers when we were on Yankee Station.
And oh, okay.
So we were given permission by the carrier to steam within a half mile of it. So the guys that were lucky got to go on the up on the single bridge, which is the topmost, that was above the conning, above the bridge. We had big eyes, which are basically about 100x power binoculars used to read signal flags.
Okay.
And we got to go up and look at 4,000 or 5,000 guys on a carrier deck, the stage, and what looked like Bob Hope and Go-Go Dancers. I still remember Go-Go Dancers.
Right.
And that was so cool to see Bob Hope from maybe 2,000 yards away, I don't know, maybe 1,000. But to have a man like that, to have people like that come out to see us in the middle of the ocean, 7,000 miles away, is something I have told my daughters how much I appreciate that man and how special that was. We were all excited just to see him, just to see the ship with the people on it. That's how starved we were for entertainment.
Right.
So, summarizing then, I had really on the ship two sets of duties. If we were around the carriers, we did bird farm stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If we were in gun line, we were basically shooting.
Okay. All right. Why don't we go ahead and take a break for today, if you don't mind?
Okay.
All right. This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Jim Modern. Today is August 11th, 2010, and this is interview session number 2. Okay, if we could begin today, I had a couple of questions about some of the fire support missions. Could you talk a little bit, I guess, about how a fire mission would work and the way a gun crew worked? I guess what I'm getting at is what were the different jobs, and if you could talk about a fire support mission, say, from the moment you received a target to the actual firing of the gun.
Sure. Let me first go with the different crews and what they did.
Okay.
How they worked together. The ship, when we were on NGFS, Naval Gunfire Support missions, or we called it colloquially the gun line, we were in a port and starboard watch bill, in the sense that you had 4 hours on, 4 hours off, and that's how the whole ship would be set up. You had the bridge manned normally as you would underway, which you have the officer of the deck, junior officer of the deck, two lookouts. You'd have lee helm and the helm. Helm is the steering wheel, and the lee helm is the engine order commands. And then you'd have stern lookouts.
Okay.
And you'd have the petty officer of the watch, which would be running the enlisted portion of the watch, reporting to the officer of the deck. We'd also have a navigation detail with probably two, maybe three people in navigation doing precision sighting and charting where the ship was. It was very important to understand, relative to landmarks, where the ship was, so that the gunfire computer would be able to give accurate instructions to the gun mount and set the fuse at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
So one part of the crew was the bridge. You'd also have right behind the bridge on the same level, Combat Information Center, which we call CIC, and that crew would be duplicating what the bridge was doing in terms of positioning, taking bearings and ranges from landmarks they could get on radar, and making sure that their posit of where the ship was, the position where the ship was, agreed with what the bridge did. And the bridge's position was done visually, and the combat information center was done by radar, and they really had to match. Everything was very focused on safety for the troops and accuracy for the to hit the target.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the combat information center also was the radio telephone network when it came out over a speaker about the size, twice the size of a grapefruit. The communications with the spotter. And again, as I said yesterday, spotter would either be in the air in a Bronco, OVA Bronco, small observation plane, or on the ground with the troops.
Okay.
Most of the spotters were in the air. The radio telephone network also was on the bridge, and so that people would be able to ascertain that if there was a confusion on what the spotter had said, you would check with the bridge or the you'd have probably had six or seven people or more listening to the spotter's directions.
Okay.
In the center of the ship, the bowels of the ship, you'd have gunfire plot, and that was the Mark 1 Able electrical mechanical computer about the size of a large desk, and it would be the computer that would be used to determine or to point the guns in the right place. We'd be going probably 3 to 5 knots, so the speed of advance was not important.
Okay.
But the other portions of the gun commands were: you would put in a barometric pressure, you'd put in wind, and we had wind reports from 7th Fleet or the op area that would have wind at different elevations, which was important if you were shooting long distances, especially RAP, rocket-assisted projectiles. You would have temperature of the magazines. You do it a 5-day average. Then you would also do calculations of the wear of the gun bores, the guns you'd be shooting. That was important also.
Mm-hmm.
The guns had probably 30, maybe 50,000 rounds of life, and it was relatively common for a ship to have to pull the sleeves of a barrel when they got worn out. There's a grooves, and they put a spin on the shell for accuracy.
Okay.
And they're worn out through repeated firing. The three areas I just mentioned were the crews on a ship that basically determined where the ship was, what the commands were or the spotter's directions were, and set the commands into the computer, setting the computer.
Mm-hmm.
In
okay.
the actual gun, and this was common to all 5-inch 38 mounts, we had two mounts, two guns each, and they shot a projectile of 58 pounds, and I believe the powder casing was 34 pounds. And the powder casing was brass, and the round itself varied based on the mission you chose. So we had in their magazine a variety of charges, anti-aircraft, which is AAC, which was a time fuse.
Mm-hmm.
I like to use that for troops in the open. We had DT frag, which was also a fragmentation warhead that had a little radar in its actually in the base, and it would go off when it approached ground. I liked that. Did not have this big a charge, but it was fairly effective.
Okay.
And then you had high cap, which was used for bunkers or anything that appeared to be fortified. We didn't use much of that because of just our terrain and where we were in Tukor.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The mounts were set up so that you had a crew in three levels. The first topside level were the gun mount itself, and then below that was an upper handling room, and you can call that a ready magazine if you wanted. And below that was actually the magazine itself, where the powder and shells were stored. The crews for a 5-inch gun included the following. You have a mount captain, who would usually be a very experienced third-class petty officer or perhaps a second-class petty officer. You'd have a trainer and pointer, and that person would be somebody who would be manually, if necessary, moving the gun to left and right or changing the elevation. You had two men that would take the powder out of the upper of the hoist, and the other would take the projectile out of the projectile hoist. So you had two hoists that were coming up from the upper handling room,
okay,
which was a round room in the deck immediately below the mount, and they would take the projectile and put that in a tray that when the breech was open of the gun, and the powder handler would take the powder charge and put that behind it, and then a hydraulic ram would push the projectile and powder casing into the breech. It would lock, and the mount captain would say ready for fire, or he would signal he was ready for fire.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A good crew could fire 15 rounds a minute per barrel on a steady state. Sometimes they could do 22 rounds for 3 to 5 minutes, but the shells were fairly big, so you'd have your big strapping bosun mates or gunner's mates doing the loading.
Mm-hmm.
Below, as I said before, that's the mount, and the mount would be set up usually in automatic, so it would be under the command of the people in plot who are running where the gun was going to be trained, left or right, and the elevation.
Mm-hmm.
When we're using time-fused rounds, Abel Common was an example, the gun plot computer would set the time of flight into the shell, and as the shells were coming up the powder hoist, there was a device that was like a screwdriver, if you will, that set the time of flight in the base of the fuse. The projectiles would come up the hoist nose first. They'd sit on their base, and this device would be receiving commands from plot, changing time of flight right up until the projectile was taken out of the hoist and put in the tray and then rammed into the breech of the gun.
Mm-hmm.
Time of flight was important because the computer would calculate your where the ship was and the distance time of flight, and if we wanted to have a burst 60 feet instead of 30 feet, it might be a split second, that the time of flight would be a split second less, and it's to get the proper height.
Okay.
So the mount crew was the crew that physically operated the gun itself, and when we were doing normal gunfire support, you would have both. You'd probably do one mount, and you'd trade off between the two mounts, but you would most likely have both guns manned in case we had to use both guns. Underneath the gun mount was the ready handling room, and these This was a room probably same dimensions of the mount. It was, but it had two concentric rings in a round space. Top ring held the projectiles, and the bottom ring held the powder charges.
Okay.
The projectiles were loaded in advance based on what the gunnery officer had requested from gun plot, and whether they wanted, we'd always have maybe a half dozen high cap. And if we were going to shoot Able of Common that day or VT frag, we'd have that loaded into the ready magazine.
Okay.
The powder was on the lower ring, as I said.
Right.
And the powder would be, if it was night, I think we'd use flashless, and daytime we'd use non-flashless. And the reason being is that if you are out and you have night vision and you're on the bridge and you use the wrong powder, the powder that's used in the daytime, you are pretty much blinded because you have all this light that is created by the muzzle blast.
Okay.
Navy had developed powder charge that did not have a light. It was basically same power, same projectile, but it was more smoke than light. So when you got to be dusk, we would have to change over from non-flashless to flashless powder. So that was important. Bridge didn't like losing their eyesight at night. You tend to get growls from the captain.
Right.
Sometimes, if we were in hilly country, we'd also have short charges, which I mentioned before, were charges that had less propulsion power in them and allowed you to lob a shell into the reverse side of a hill. Naval gunfire has extremely high muzzle velocity, very flat, and it was therefore very accurate and very good for line of sight targets or targets that are straight from the ship to where the target was, but not effective on the reverse side or of a mountain or a hill. That's why you had to use the short charges. So the three levels, again, were the mount. We talked about the mount crew, the upper handling room. And the upper handling room would be manned probably by four to six people, depending on the activity we expect to happen.
Okay.
And then down below the upper handling room on the third level, the bottommost level, was the magazine. And this is where the projectiles and the powder was securely stored for sea. And it was armored to the extent the ship was armored, and you had a watertight hatch between the to get in. And there, by the way, there was no direct access from one compartment, from the gun mount to the upper handling room to the magazine, other than the projectile and powder hoists. And they were closed off. So if you had an explosion in the upper handling room, it wouldn't light off anything that was in the gun mount or go to the magazine and light that off, which would have been catastrophic for the ship.
Sure.
In the magazine, there'd be the same number of people that would be in the upper handling room, ready handling room. Probably be five or six, and you would have your second class there, an experienced person, because those are the people that would be picking out the rounds and trying to manage the inventory. You'd rotate your inventory. The oldest out first, if you depending on your shell stock, how long you'd had the magazine load. When you're out on the gun line, though, you'd go through everything fairly quickly, with the exception of perhaps your star shells and your Willie Peter, your white phosphorus, which tended to be special missions.
Okay.
So if you had six people in the magazine and another six people in the upper handling room, that's 12, and you had, what did I say, that's four, five, seven, another 7 people, that's 13, and you had 5 people in the gun plot. Help me with my math, that's 18.
Mm-hmm.
You probably had 5 in combat, that's 23, and you had 3 people, especially in navigation, 26 would be the navigators, in addition to the normal bridge watch.
Okay.
That'd be the number you'd have for a gunfire support mission.
Okay.
Does this answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, we would have 2 crews. You'd have a port and a starboard, or a blue and gold. And so you'd be on, and if you're firing a lot, there'd be a lot to do, and sometimes there wouldn't be anything to do. Everyone was always taking measurements. Before we'd fire each day, I had the responsibility of checking the gunfire recoil seals, and these are the hydraulic seals that when the gun fired, there was a hydraulic recoil mechanism that absorbed the blast and make sure that the gun breech did not go out of the creen out of the mount. And so it was very, very important for me to have hydraulic fuel or hydraulic fluid to keep these pistons. I think it was between 2,200 and 2,400 PSI.
Mm.
When I first came on board ship, my my department head brought me into his office, and I was really a green ensign. He said, "Ensign Modern, I want you to get recoil fluid and get it here by tomorrow." And I didn't know that he tried to do that himself before I got there. There were 2 squadrons that had left in the last 3 weeks from San Diego, and they had taken all the hydraulic fluid. So there really was none to be found. But he made me feel that my existence on Earth was depended on finding this hydraulic fluid. And I looked head all over the place, and I gave it to my chiefs. And finally, the chief came back. His name was Butler, Chief Butler. And he told me the situation, and I said, "Well, no wonder he told me get it," because he couldn't. So
right.
One of the things you learned hopefully you learned quickly when you're a division officer, you learned who was your best scrounger.
Mm-hmm.
Scrounger was a term that was a person who'd come out and do comm shop, basically do exchange. A scrounger is somebody who go find something.
Right.
And depending on his comm shop skills, you would get it for a certain price. So I had a gunner's mate, third class, named Coffin. I had pretty much determined that he had the slick personality and the inquisitive nature of a card shark and probably a conniver.
Right.
And I said, "I want to see Coffin." So I said, "I need 60 gallons of hydraulic fluid here by tomorrow noon. I don't care how you get it. I just want it here, and I don't want to know how you got it."
Right.
And I get a call from the quarterdeck 10 in the morning the next day, and there's Coffin with he had actually 100 gallons. He was pleased with punch. I never knew how he got it.
Oh, wow.
And typically, though, especially when you're overseas, a lot of exchange, especially in the Subic Bay Naval Station, was with Coffin. Coffee came, I think, in 5-pound tins, about 2.5 feet high and about 18 inches square. So that was, you get a lot of things done with crane operators and other things like that by giving them five pounds of coffee.
Okay.
Gloves, work gloves were another thing. So that is the crew and generally how we operated on a naval gunfire mission.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, one other question about along those lines, I suppose. Any particularly memorable fire missions that stick out in your mind? I know you mentioned the one with the VC on the trail having their fun, but any others that stick out in your mind that you could possibly talk about?
We had one that typically the spotters would be up in the air, and sometimes you would see they would see men in the open, and that they would pretty much determine that they had guns. They could sight them visually with binoculars. And
mm-hmm.
We had a couple. One where we had what the vehicle was. It was a Jeep-like vehicle, may have been the stolen U.S. Jeep, and it was going down a road. And the spotter got all excited, and so instead of a target that's moving at 3 miles an hour, as someone would when they walk, we had something moving about 20 miles an hour down a road. And so we got on that right away, and we had about three shells. One, the first spot came in after the behind the guy on the road, whatever road this was,
mm-hmm.
and the road wasn't straight. And the next spot was to the right, and the third shell was in front, and the fourth shell was right on him. But here's this guy driving down the road as fast as he could. The road was not straight, and so we are getting these spots. You'd normally get fire coordinates on a map, and you'd shoot, and then he'd say up 500, up 100, right 50, up 100 feet or yards, and then right, and then he'd cone right in.
Mm-hmm.
But our spots were up 200, left 75, up 100, right 25, and it was a really pretty big spot, so mm-hmm. that was sort of fun.
Right.
And we'd always, that was one. A second one, we had a mission where there was a firefight going on, and the spotter came on, and he was pretty excited. And these spotters would be different. Spotters would be the same person for a mission, but they may have rotated, taking turns, or they certainly may have been rotated out of the area completely.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you certainly got to know a spotter. If they stayed up, he knew his Southern drawl, or he knew his Yankee twang, but different ones have different cadence.
Mm-hmm.
We had one that came up, and he was all excited. And evidently there was a firefight going on, and basically we had to put down three or four rounds a spot, and then we had something like 30 rounds fire for effect, which means you basically take both guns and shoot 15 shells a minute. So that was for 30 rounds. That would be pretty much shooting pretty fast both guns for to get your 30 rounds out. And that was sort of exciting. I remember that, and it apparently was, well, it was successful because we got the body count. We'd always get a body count afterwards, KIA, we kept sort of a hash mark in gun plot, basically a grease pencil, how many bodies, you don't have much to do there when you're out mm-hmm. to sea like that. So that was one of the things we kept score, if you will.
Right, right.
So that was one mission that I remember. Most of them were probably three spots and then five rounds or 10 rounds, and that would pretty much do what the spotter wanted to have done. When you have a 58-pound shell exploding over your head, it have a range of about probably extreme range, maybe 100 yards for the shrapnel. So
mm-hmm.
you put 5 rounds, 10 rounds in a tight cluster, and it's all able to common. You're going to pretty much shred anything that is organic matter,
mm-hmm.
Soft or even medium hard organic matter around. So nothing much was left of a target when we fired into it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a story of the New Jersey, and there's an island, I don't have the name, it was immediately north of the DMZ, and the New Jersey, it was back the first time this happened, I believe, timing-wise, and the New Jersey was doing gunfire support on at the DMZ, and they could shoot, I think, 20, 24 miles. We shot 9 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And some North Vietnamese battery opened fire on it from an island in North Vietnamese waters. The story goes the New Jersey changed its target from whatever it was shooting at to the island and spent all day shooting at the island. The
mm-hmm.
Navy map people, the chart people, had to re-chart the island because of, it was all blown away.
Wow.
The mountains were not there. It was so dramatic that the island, which had been used for navigation purposes, was altered, and the chart people had to relook at it and change the chart. So,
right.
you didn't want to mess with a battleship, and you certainly, in a smaller sense, we were pretty effective as a gun platform also.
Mm-hmm.
We always got a kick. Every once in a while, the Army would come out to see us. They were curious, and we had one Huey land on our deck, flight deck. And these guys, we thought we were in really rock. It was really calm water. It was just nothing going on. And these guys get out. There's got bandoliers of. Ammo. They've got hand grenades hanging off. They've got their rifles. In about 3 minutes, they're all seasick.
Right.
It's just sort of, it's amusing to us because it was hardly any perceptible movement of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, really quite severe for them, which is interesting because when you go to sea, you'd probably get your sea legs in about 3 days. If you got seasick, you would probably be over that in a day and a half. Everyone, by the way, has a motion they will get sick in.
Okay.
And it's just whatever you enter, however your inner ear works.
Right.
But I've had a situation, and it's very common, when you've been at sea for month and a half, especially if it was fairly rocky, you would come on land, and you start staggering around because your inner ear, your body's telling you to adjust for a moving deck, and the deck's not moving because the pier doesn't move.
Mm-hmm.
So it's relatively common, and happened to me once or twice, to get have a reverse, that you get off the ship and you're staggering around because the ground's not moving like a ship's deck normally would.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So sort of the reverse. But it was fairly easy to adjust for land, maybe after a half hour or so. So, back to your questions.
Okay. All right. Well, that's pretty much the questions I had. Did you want to move on to Typhoon Joan now?
Sure. I want to do a couple things that I didn't.
Okay.
And this, by the way, is this going to be written? Is this interview going to be written up in some more coherent form than I'm giving you?
Well, it will be it will be transcribed basically verbatim as it's. We edit it to take out mistakes and things, but as far as speaking, it's what is said.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, then let me go over a couple things, and I'll go into Typhoon Joan, was one of the highlights. Something that we who were on the ship won't forget. But one of the things that you asked me before was about morale of the crew.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about that last night, and I think that we all had pretty good morale. We were there to do a job. We weren't pleased to be away. Many of especially the married people or the people that had sweethearts were not pleased to be away from them.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone pretty much was in this little community, 340-ish men on this 390-foot ship, and you get used to it, develop your own routine, and different personalities come out. Most of the guys were extremely sociable and malleable and melded together. We had really guys of all races and, I guess, creeds, because we didn't really wear religion on our sleeves, really worked together and being affected together. We had notable personalities, and certainly the chiefs had personalities. Some of the bosun mates were colorful.
Mm-hmm.
And my department, one of my department heads was interesting. I still remember the guy named Duck, D-U-C-K, bosun mate Duck, second class, or might have been first class. And we had a real smart mouth seaman who had been perpetual problem, evidently. And he was sent to the mess decks. That's where the crew ate, and he was in the cleaning detail. Duck was the really ramrod straight, built like a brick, had a great physique. And evidently the seaman mouthed off to Duck when Duck said, swab that deck and that over there. And the seaman mouthed off, so Duck picked him up, put his hand under the guy's jaw and picked him up off the floor and banged his head against the bulkhead, said, "You will swab the deck as I tell you to," and then let him down with one hand.
Right.
We learned on the ship as officers that sometimes you would let the senior enlisted take care of bad news guys that way, and mm-hmm. it worked out just well. And Duck was quite effective that way.
Right.
We also had a guy who was my really first experience, was really a Captain Quig-like man. He had he was a department head, my department head, from the academy, a brilliant man, extremely smart, but he had a just abysmal people skills. He was a screamer.
Mm-hmm.
In the Navy, there's a term called screamer, and those are people who basically like to get in someone's face and yell at them at the top of their lungs.
Right.
Either makes them feel good or they get results from it. And my department head was a guy like that, and he was not liked by... people admired him for his abilities, but the crew, enlisted crew especially, did not like him for his personality. I found out 7 years after leaving the ship, and I was in Great Lakes, met one of my officer buddies at Reserves, and evidently on the first tour when we were going to go to Hong Kong, the deck division had collected money to give him a one-way sampan ride.
Right.
And I suspect that would have happened had we not gotten into a storm, the typhoon, and not gone to Hong Kong. But that was just interesting. This guy would have mid watches, which would be between midnight and 4 a.m, and he would get mad at something and call you at 3 a.m. and want to know an answer to something.
Wow.
And you may have just got off the watch and in deep sleep, and it was annoying to have that type of experience.
Right. Sure.
I talked also yesterday about water hours and how that was real important, especially if you were at sea in hot weather.
Mm-hmm. Right.
One of the things I didn't mention was bug juice.
Okay.
Bug juice was the term for the mess decks and in the wardroom for Kool-Aid. Basically, the water we made was usually marginal in the sense it tasted like oil.
Okay.
And so what the cooks would do would put Kool-Aid-like flavoring in the water so it disguised that. And so you'd have green bug juice. We mostly had red bug juice, and it was, I don't know how the term came up, but it was quite you just drink it for the water. You didn't drink it for the flavor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Also, we talked about the different duties assigned the destroyers when they were in the operating area, AOA. One was Yankee Station, and the other was Gunfire Line, which we just talked about a few minutes ago. In Yankee Station, one of the things that the officers of the deck, certainly junior officers, we had a signal book. The signal book would be a combination of you had a standing signal book, then you'd have a special code wheel. We called them whiz wheels.
Okay.
That were changed daily. A whiz wheel was a round plastic ring, and you'd on a daily basis at a certain time put a paper at the bottom of the whiz wheel so that you'd have a different array of outside letters and inside letters in two concentric circles. And you would, especially when you were talking to spotters, or people on the ground, you would get a call for fire and you'd ask for authentication. And you'd say, I set, request authentication, I set Alpha Romeo. And the other side would put their whiz wheel, their opening on Alpha November, whatever I just said, and then call out what the opposite, whatever the wheel said in the other opening.
Okay.
We had a couple times where the VC or NVA would try to get us to call fire on our own troops.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd come up on the circuit, they'd find the circuit, the radio circuit, and they'd say, call for fire. Battering Ram was our call sign. Battering Ram, this is Red Fox, requests fire mission, and then the ship would come back, Red Fox, this is Battering Ram, requests authentication, I set Alpha November, and you'd expect them to come back, and they'd be silent.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that the officers learned, though, we always were afraid of on the Yankee Station, is that we were hanging around the bird farms, the carriers, which were high-priority targets, and we knew that we knew our little world, which would be pretty much what we could see, and we would read Armed Forces Network news as it came out, which
mm-hmm.
would be a week old or something like that, or something come off over the radio. But we always had never knew what was going on with the Soviets. And the Soviets sometimes would have a missile cruiser nearby, especially when you were in the Sea of Japan, and we always thought, well, this is not good. And there was a command, I can't remember what it was, in the standard code book, which was a NATO code book that was basically to destroyers, to escorts, set your electronic gear, we had the electronic countermeasures gear to blip enhance and proceed at this speed on this at this course, which means you pretend you're the carrier and go away from me while I shut down all my electronic gear and try to hide. That meant that there was an incoming raid on the carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And we always were very alert for that blip enhance command. We always had that memorized. We never heard it, fortunately.
Right.
Okay. One of the things want to talk about Typhoon Jung, which was quite extraordinary, and unless you have questions, talk about really some of the Liberty ports we went to and what they were like and what people did.
Okay. Sure.
Typhoon Jung was a 1970 typhoon that surprised the 7th Fleet and certainly us. The ship, the Agerholm, had been on plane guard duty in Tonkin Gulf, and we were released to go to Hong Kong for, I think, 5 days R&R.
Okay.
Typically, ships would rotate in and out of Hong Kong. That was really one of the favorite R&R places. There was a station ship assignment that was 2 weeks, but the ships would normally get 3 days to 5 days. And I came up very quickly with my experience with Hong Kong over my years in the Navy, that out of money in Hong Kong, no matter how much you begin with, after 3 days.
Right.
So it was one of those three-day ports. You had most of the ports were 5 days. Hong Kong was a three-day port.
Mm-hmm.
But we were we proceeded and proceeded north, going to around Hainan Island, and the weather the barometer went down and the waves came up. And as a side note, one of my reserve buddies told me, oh, must have been 15 years later, he was at Fleet Weather Center Guam at the time, that they had misplotted where by 500 miles where the typhoon was.
Oh, wow.
And we thought this typhoon was a ways away and there was no problem. But basically, as we were going, if you have a mind's eye view, we were going from the Gulf of Tonkin up around Hainan Island to Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
This typhoon was heading towards the mainland, and it got between us and it put us between the land and the ocean. We couldn't maneuver away from, couldn't turn east to get away. We had to go south and go through the waves. But anyway, we the first day transit was fine. Second day, the waves and winds started coming up. By the night of the third day, we were into seas that would probably, we had water going over the bridge, green water over the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
We eventually had to turn, and we were trying to do this. The water, basically, we had waves over the first stack, green water down the stack. So the ship was going down, burying itself to where the top of the mount was visible, and then would come up to where really quite a bit, I imagine, quite a bit of the red lead under below the waterline was visible. But we were all by ourselves, of course, and it was you couldn't sleep. You had to tie your in. I was in the forward broom closet. Mentioned the really small officers' quarters, and I had to tie. You had to tie yourself to bed.
Oh, wow!
Because you would be when you went up, you'd go up, and you'd be thrown up, so you'd really lose about a third of your weight, and then you go down and have about half of a G as you come back up. One of the waves came and hit the ship, and I was just getting ready for to go on watch.
Mm-hmm.
I had just put on my shoes, and all of a sudden I was hurled. I was sitting in my bottom bunk, and it was hurled through. The ship took a port heel and went up. We went up to about 58 degrees, I was told later.
In
the capsize point was 45 or 48 degrees.
Oh, wow.
But I was basically thrown through the entrance to our stateroom, and I was standing on the bulkhead on the opposite of this door, and this was actually had a curtain. That was the curtain. I looked up, and there was my bunk, it was 45, 55, 58 degrees above me, and all of a sudden, I had a Big Ben clock I had purchased in San Diego to help me to set alarm to get awake for watches and things like that. And
mm-hmm.
I had it taped to the bulkhead. All of a sudden, this thing is about a 1 pound clock, these big metal clocks. It comes spinning by my head, and it hits the bulkhead that I'm standing on, and it missed me by about 2 or 3 inches, and just breaks into all these little pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately for the ship, instead of capsizing, another wave came on the other side and pushed us back.
Wow.
So it was quite something. The when the morning came, first had these huge, monstrous waves. It looked like one of the Scandinavian Maelstrom myths. If you remember about the Vikings and the Maelstrom, which is somewhere a big whirlpool that sucks ships and things into the sea. This, we looked in the there were waves at least to the height of our radar, 100-foot waves.
Oh wow!
And that we had this 390-foot ship. We had we were surfing down these waves. The waves had come underneath us. We turned around, and the stern would lift up, and we would go down, start going down these waves, and we would start gaining speed faster than the rudder would hold. So all of a sudden, we lose control of the ship, and the challenge was if you come down and at the base of the wave, and then the next wave comes. But the challenge is that the wind would take and try to push the ship sideways. If we turn sideways, the next wave would roll over the ship, broach it, and turn us over. So we had we had to turn the ship, and the Captain Taylor, who I mentioned yesterday, phenomenal ship handler, basically found the right time, turned the ship, and so we basically, instead of stern to the waves, we were bow to the waves. Now that was a harder ride, but it was safer.
Okay.
So we were, the wind was howling, and it was just screaming. You could barely hear yourself, and you'd be standing in the bridge, and you'd look out one wing, and you'd see water. We would do a rock, and then you look out the other wing, and see when you'd come on the other side, and see the water, and it was just quite something. We'd lost all communications. We lost we lost a life raft. We lost we lost all the radio antenna. The fleet thought we lost contact, and they would start sending out planes for us. We did not. It was told everyone to stay off of the main decks because we had lost people. We had a couple waves come when they took. We had big reels where mooring lines were on that were welded to the deck.
Okay.
A couple waves took the mooring line reels and ripped them off and left 3-inch square holes in the deck, and it started to flood out after steering. So right when we're trying to do these maneuverings, all of a sudden we lose a power steering.
Wow.
We have to make these changes. We have electrical fires after steering, and the damage control people had to go down and put out the fire, refix the electricity, and plug the hole. So here's these people after steering, steering the ship with big cranks that were going up and down, as I mentioned, and rocking back and forth excessively, and it was quite hairy.
Sounds like it.
So we're all ahead, two-thirds on one engine, back one-third on the other, trying to stay into the wind. And we start, all of a sudden the water starts shoaling, which means the water becomes shallower. And pretty soon we started getting some on the radar, surface radar, started getting some blips that did not look like waves. You had blips all over because these waves were as 100 feet up, you'd have them all over. They'd be reflecting radar, the radar transmissions.
Right.
And it turns out we were going right through the Paracel Island chain.
And
we were driven by the storm. We couldn't really maneuver, and we were actually driven between two islands that the charts had 23, 25 feet of water. We displaced on our sonar dome 28 feet of water.
Wow.
So we went through these two islands, and they're probably a mile apart. And it was just luck. It was just God's grace that we went through. And the because the storm had raised the water level, we didn't hit any rocks.
Hmm. Wow.
So we finally get this is about a day and a half.
Okay.
And everyone's tired. First of all, you're bruised. When you go down the passageway, the ship wouldn't rock. It would throw you violently. And so what you would do is you would have a handhold, and you'd look for your next one. And when the ship would be in the middle of a roll, you would walk quickly to the next one and hold yourself. And because we had power problems, again, we had an old destroyer, we had battle lanterns on at night, and the daytime was just a low gray. We had low light. It was not clear at all.
Mm-hmm.
We had picked up when we were on the gun line prior to Yankee Station, two South Vietnamese naval cadets. They were Bang and Chow. So they've been on board about 2 months, and I guess we're looking forward to going to Hong Kong with us. I get them mixed up. I think Bang was the CIC officer, and Chow was an engineering officer.
Okay.
Bang thought he didn't like to go into combat because he thought the radio circuits, the radio noise, they thought there were spirits in the CIC.
Okay.
And Chow didn't like to go down where the boilers were because it was hot. He said, "Officer, don't go down where it's hot." And so we were beginning to wonder if these are our allies, what was going to happen out of Vietnamization. But anyway,
mm-hmm, right.
We'd been, Bang and Chow were in after officers. And after a day, they got hungry. And we didn't serve, the ship didn't serve in the storm hot meals because the cooks would be scalded by any water because they'd be thrown off of the stove or any hot skillets or pans or whatever.
Right.
So we had cold cuts, basically bologna, cheese, stuff like that, frozen bread.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite memories of the storm, and you had to be. We thought we were always going to live forever. I'll tell you that the ship, I always thought, and guys around me, that we were going to live forever. We
mm-hmm.
were at the height of our youth. We were with a bunch of guys we liked. We had all this fun stuff we could do. We did what we're told, but we thought we were going to live forever. Anyway, I'm getting ready to go on mid-watch, and I think maybe at 10 o'clock watch. It's either 9 o'clock at night or 11 o'clock at night. And there is, I'm getting ready to, I think it was probably about 11 o'clock, 11:15 at night.
Okay.
And in the stateroom was probably about 30 feet wide, had a linoleum floor. And in the general quarters, it was where we had, we had sort of the sick bay or basically were, did rudimentary operations. And the stewards had set up on a buffet among the cabinets going crossways to the ship's length. Bread they had unfrozen. They had a 5-gallon can of mayonnaise, a big can of mayonnaise,
because
they didn't have anything smaller. They had cheese and cold cuts.
Right.
And so, and we have, there's no lights other than these low light battle lanterns because we had trouble with electricity and also the ongoing watch one to keep its night vision.
Okay.
And we're fixing our we have bug juice and we're fixing our sandwiches, and all of a sudden the wave comes and knocks the 5-gallon can of mayonnaise on the deck.
Mm-hmm.
Makes it as slick as ice.
Right.
And so we're sliding, all of a sudden we can't hold on anything, and so when the ship goes port, we slide by the sandwiches and then we goes starboard, we'd slide on the, another way.
And right.
So there were about five of us, so we were all sliding in unison. And about this time, Bang or Chow, we don't know which one of them, came in, and he sees this, and he sort of gets in the corner, and we're having a good time. We're sort of screaming, laughing, because we didn't have any sleep for a day and a half.
Right.
If we pass the bologna, you'd grab a piece of bologna or put mayonnaise or whatever, mustard on your bread.
Mm-hmm.
And then about the same time, a huge mahogany cabinet that had been used for and put in by a former previous wardroom that had our TV and stereo system, that comes unbolted from the bulkhead.
Mm-hmm.
And so water's starting to come in when the waves and mixes with the mayonnaise. But this big thing, it probably weighed about 300 or 400 pounds, it made in the Philippines, it starts chasing us. Basically sliding on the floor like we were.
Right.
But we realized quickly it went the same speed we did.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, when it was going away from us, we could get our bread and fixings. But when it was coming towards us, we'd have to jump up on one of these couches that had a built-in metal base that was used as a operating table, and this big thing would crash against us. And we were whooping and hollering, and just really sort of crazy fun.
Right.
Evidently just scared the bejesus out of this Vietnamese guy. he told, when they did the debrief to the U.S., when they left the ship, they thought that they enjoyed the time there with us, but they thought American officers were crazy. And they used the example of the wardroom, and this sliding and thinking it was funny and fun.
Right.
When this spirit, this big cabinet was trying to kill him. And it was you had to be there to really appreciate it, but it was just nuts in the extreme. We finally cleared the storm, and we pull into Subic Bay, probably in the storm, day and a half, 2 days.
Okay.
One of the guys, as soon as we put the gangway over and start people going back and forth, one of the guys came out and kissed the ground. It was really quite something.
Right.
It turns out there were major cracks in the hull that we thought we were going to be in the base for 3 to 4 days. Turns out we were in for about a month and a half.
Oh, wow.
The ship was old, as I said. We had major cracks in the hull that they had to be rewelded. We had one of the stacks was weakened, and that had to be reinforced. It would just really wreck the ship.
Mm, mm-hmm.
So Typhoon Joan was something that that I'll always remember, and yet there was really a fun. It was really a fun fun time, and I look back.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's the Typhoon Joan. Any questions on that?
Just one. Was anyone injured as a result of it?
No one had major injuries. Everyone had bruises.
Okay.
Any piece of equipment that was not secure, it was really interesting. Initially, when we got in the storm, you'd hear things banging around, like a pump would break loose or a portable generator break loose.
Mm-hmm.
You hear banging around, and guys would rush out and tie it down. But after a while, the things that banged around, they broke up, and then all the little pieces broke up into smaller pieces.
Mm-hmm.
It was just that violent a storm.
Right. Right. All right. Well, I guess that's the only question I have.
Okay. I wanted to go over just what one of the things that if you're in the Navy, unlike the Army and Air Force, you go to different ports when you are going with your ship from Gunline or from Yankee Station. And we really enjoyed a couple ports. The primary one we went to was Subic Bay in the Philippines, which was the largest naval base outside of the continental U.S. It was almost as large as San Diego. And there were sometimes 7,000 to 10,000 men that would come through that base, that naval station, on a 3-day station. We have a carrier come in and a marine readiness group. You'd have 7,000 to 10,000 men. And Olongapo, which was the town outside the base, was probably as wild as Dodge City was at the height of the cattle drive.
Right.
You had armed guards, people with rifles at the entrance of all these bars, and everyone had a favorite bar. There'd be the Zanzibar Club, the Jolo Club, the New Jolo Club, Texas Bar, and East End Supper Club, and it was just quite interesting that different guys like to go different places. Some were pleasant. Many of them were low. I'll call them low class, if you will. Mm-hmm. What was interesting is some of the they always had fairly good bands. One of the things that has happened probably because of the American involvement with the Philippines is the Filipinos, up until maybe recently, and I don't have experience in the last 3 years, are really the best rock and roll people. They play rock and roll real well, where the Chinese and Japanese did not.
Mm-hmm.
So we had there was one bar, it was a Zanzibar Club, that always had Janis Joplin imitators, and they were actually pretty good. So the Subic Bay was quite a place, and you would have just wild times. One of my yeomen, his name is Myos, M-Y-O-S-E. He was a Japanese American.
Okay.
He refused to go ashore. And I said, why? And he said, because I'm Japanese American, and they basically, he was afraid of his life because of what had happened in World War II.
Right.
So Subic was legendary, and you could go on the internet and find out about the revelry that happened. And anything off limits was dangerous. There was two of my guys came back once, and they were as white as a sheet, and I asked them what happened. And they were off in Subic City, which was off limits. They were at a bar. The guard came in with a pistol and blew the back of the head of a man next to them, a Filipino, and blew it out with a pistol right next to him.
Right.
And they basically said they're never going to go to Subic City again. And I don't blame them.
Right, sure.
One of the experiences, too, in when you get into the monsoons, where it rained and you couldn't see 100 feet. All your clothes were wet and moist. It wasn't as bad as the Army and Marines in Vietnam, certainly, but when you put on wet underwear in the morning, you certainly can use your body heat to dry it out was really a treat.
Right.
You had your shoes, the officers, listed two, and have shoes, and your shoes would rot out. You basically get mildew in your shoes, and they just fall apart. So shoes would last probably 6 months or so, and then you would have to replace them. So I always had a pair of dress shoes for uniforms, black shoes, but my work shoes would only last 6 months or so before they would just literally fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much what I wanted to say to you, other than the next year after we got the storm, the ship was assigned station ship in Hong Kong.
Okay.
To sort of compensate for not making it the first year and about getting sunk. And that was quite an experience. We were in the harbor, stationed there for two weeks. We all ran out of money.
Mm-hmm.
We spent time in Wan Chai, which is Susie Wong town, if you remember the movie.
Okay.
And just quite experienced. There was everyone had a favorite bar. My group had the Pussycat Bar, and we almost got I almost got married there once to Julie Chow.
Okay.
She didn't have, it was really a cute girl. We were drinking one night and getting ready to go back to ship, and you know, have these bar girls asking you to buy them drinks. Of course, they got a commission off the drinks.
Sure.
And one girl said, buy me a drink. And I said, no, I can't because my girlfriend's here. And she said, what's your girlfriend's name? I turned to my buddy, Dean Whitehead. I said, what's my girl's name? And I didn't, and he turned to the lady badgering him, and he told me, Julie Chow. So I said, my girlfriend's Julie Chow. So about 3 minutes later, I have a tap on my shoulder. This really cute little Chinese girl beaming, say, hi, I'm Julie Chow. And so these guys, we'd come back, and Mama-san and Julie Chow would be there. And so one night we were really blotto. And towards the end of the 2 weeks, and Dean Knuth and Whitehead, all of a sudden they start bartering with the Mama-san, who was the operating manager of the bar. Mama-san's always ran the place, and
he's
worked to get married and for her to be my bride. And these guys we weren't serious, but they were. And fortunately, I found a way to said, make sure we have 20 ducks in the dowry. They didn't have enough ducks in the dowry, so I went back 15 years later on one of my cruises.
Mm-hmm.
And saw Mama-san, and Julie married a lawyer, lives in Kowloon, very happy. But it's really, just really interesting to have that type of thing happen.
Right.
After the second tour, I requested in-country Vietnam. I liked shooting. I liked shooting. And
mm-hmm.
It was winding down, so they gave me Fleet Training Group, Guantanamo.
Okay.
Fleet Training Group basically was the Atlantic Fleet's training ground for all the new construction ships, as well as ships that were coming out of the yard. So I was able to live in Guantanamo for a year, and I got to do even more shooting in Guantanamo, but I didn't have to do any of the paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
I would take ships out in the morning at 7, and we go shoot 200, 300 rounds and come back, and I'd go ashore, and I'd grade them and go ashore, and it was really great.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a year in Gitmo, had a lot of fun there, met people who still are my friends, both school teachers, civilians, as well as two Marines who lived nearby me in Southern California.
Mm, okay. Right.
So, Jason, that is about it.
Okay. Well, I still have a few questions for you.
Oh, please ask.
Okay. One, I meant to ask you a little earlier when you were talking about the typhoon, about the Vietnamese that were on board. What were they doing there? Why were they on board?
Well, we had let's call it an on-the-job training program for the naval officers. They'd been through classroom school. I don't know if they'd have been on any ships yet.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy was in the process of turning over small ships, patrol craft, things like that, to them.
Okay.
And so this was a on the job training program on a U.S. destroyer.
Okay.
And the theory was they would be assigned to a officer in their specialty, an operations officer in terms of combat, or an engineering officer in terms of the boilers, the engine room, and learn how things were done. But my sense is they had a different culture, they had different priorities. We were there very Anglo-wise, factual, black and white, get things done.
Mm-hmm.
And they were probably looking over their shoulder, saying how long the government was going to last and what to do if it didn't,
mm-hmm.
which was probably smarter than we were. But they were there for training.
Mm, okay. All right. Next question I had for you. How long did you end up staying in the Navy?
Well, I stayed in almost 3 years. I got it early out. Interesting, I had a... when Vietnam, well, I was in Cuba, and Vietnam was shutting down rapidly. This was 72, and I get a message saying I was going to get a six-month early out beginning in 2 weeks. This was like December 1st or 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
And I applied. I had a reserve commission, and a reserve commission serves at the pleasure of Congress. A regular commission serves at the pleasure of the president.
Okay.
That means there's more job security. So I got an early out, and I had a three-year active, three-year reserve commitment from my ROTC scholarship and commission. So I went into the reserves and stayed in the reserves for another 22 years. I stayed in the reserves for two major reasons. One is I enjoyed the guys. When I came out, I went to the University of Wisconsin, and which was a liberal place at the time, and I had a hard time adjusting to being called a baby killer and some of the crazy liberal things going on. So I naturally had fun talking sea stories with my Navy buddies, and then I fell into a group in San Diego, and I moved out west back to San Diego, who were just a lot of fun to be with, and it was sort of like my Rotary or my Kiwanis Club.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first reason. Second is in the late 70s, the Soviets were aggressively expanding in the world, and they had detected correctly that Jimmy Carter didn't know what the hell he was doing. And Jimmy was surprised. He admitted that they invaded Afghanistan, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought there was a 30% chance of a war with the Soviets. There was a lot of theoretical discussion, actually white papers written by the Naval War College, about could you have a nuclear war at sea, nuclear exchange at sea, and not have it extend to the mainland of the two countries.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was time that I thought the Soviets would, we get in some shooting war with the Soviets because of our weakness. And then when Reagan came in and started building up, there was a period of time that the Soviets were looking at a gap that would soon close and America would rearm. And there was another period for that we could have gone to war. But I stayed in for a total of 25 years active in reserve, 27 if you count my ROTC time, because I was under government orders.
Mm-hmm.
I retired as a captain in 06, and I look back and I think it was one of the best things ever happened in my life. Not all good things. Typhoon was bad. Some of my work conditions were not always good. Some of my supervisors were, superiors were not good. But I just had a glorious time and was proud to have been able to serve my country.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, after you left active duty and went on reserve, did you continue to follow developments in Vietnam?
I did, and I was concerned about it. Clearly, Congress was being Congress, and the Watergate crisis and Nixon's resignation really ended any commitment we had made to the South Vietnamese. The North figured that out, and they attacked when they invaded with regular troops and overran the South Vietnamese army, and the state collapsed. I was just sick, and I was in a funk for about a year. For the people who had fought for their country, for the people who had assumed we would honor our word, America, and I was just stunned with the just the chutzpah of the North Vietnamese to do the invasion. My cousin, 2.5 years older than I am, married a Vietnamese woman, They now live in Twin Falls, Idaho, where we grew up. And she detests the communists. They go, but when she goes back, I think every couple of years, and they have secret police following her and try to get her to give them money, bribe them. And it's I always, when some of my colleagues at Ernst & Young, when I was partner, say, "Oh, we're going to go to Vietnam and travel there," so you can go there. Don't send me a postcard.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I did follow, and I'm disappointed what we did as a country. I'm distressed what people who made their sacrifice for their nation. And it was not our finest moment.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, to wrap up the interview, if you don't mind, if I could ask you some of those questions that touch on some of the broader issues surrounding the war. Okay. Looking back on your experiences and the way things turned out in Vietnam, how do you feel about American involvement in Vietnam? Do you think we should have been involved? And also, how do you feel about your own involvement?
Let me take the last question first because it's easiest.
Okay.
I wanted to be in the Navy. From my grade school, from the fifth grade on, I really wanted to be in the Navy. I liked ships. I thought I'd like the sea. And that turned out to be the case. It was different than I expected it to be, but by and large, it was better. So I was glad I was in the Navy. I'm glad I was in Vietnam because it really gave me the experience that I've been able to use in my life. I grew up. I came back after my first deployment. I went back to the University of Idaho in my fraternity, and I'd been only gone for 8 months, let's say, and I felt like everyone else was their own children, even guys just a year younger than me. So I grew a lot, and having to deal with all the things I've mentioned in the hours we've talked. So for me, it was good. I'm proud to have answered the call for Vietnam service. I could have equally been happy to be in the Atlantic. But frankly, I'm glad I was in the Pacific because I saw more places and I got more action. And I'm sort of an action guy. So that's my answer, I am sure, for the Vietnam portion. For the country, I believe that Americans need to understand that countries play on a chessboard. They play a game as fortunes rise and fall, economies move in and out of cycles. And I believe that at the time, it probably made sense for us to be involved. Clearly, the North Vietnamese had an intention of forcibly taking the country, which they did. What I did not like was the timidity of the U.S. government, of our president, to close Haiphong. It didn't make no sense to me when I was there in Vietnam and later to be allowing the Soviets to resupply North Vietnam's army through Haiphong. And clearly the peace settlement did not happen until we mined Haiphong. And I just think that was prosecuted the war in a foolish manner. And I think that McNamara is one of the biggest criminals of our time, of my time. And he will have to. The Lord will forgive him, because that is if he asks for it. But I think he is one of the biggest tragedies of this war. In his book, when he said he knew 2 years-ish before the war ended that it was unwinnable the way it was prosecuted, but he stayed in doing it for political reasons. I think that is a tragedy. I think that is a horrific disservice to the men and women who came after he made that conclusion and served and died or were harmed. So that's my opinion.
Okay.
I hope that helped him clear.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. All right. Next question. You mentioned the coming into some of the people on the left and their take on it, referring to Vietnam veterans as baby killers and such. Did you have much interaction with that yourself? And also, what was your take on the war protest movement?
Well, the first time encounter I had was in Seattle, and we were up on a ship visit between one deployments, and somebody spat at me and called me a baby killer, and I said, what do you mean a baby killer? We didn't have any conversation because they ran away, but that was the first time that I had read about it. We got Time magazine on the ship. We get it about a month and a half after the publish date, but it just struck me that they were against the war for a couple reasons. One was certainly policy reasons, which I would allow everyone can have a disagreement in policy. But also, there were people who were afraid of being drafted, and I could appreciate that. But there were also people who were using the war as a lightning rod for their political beliefs that went beyond the Vietnam War, that went into maybe civil rights, went into economic justice. But the Vietnam War was just a convenient way, or very effective way, to protest against what they didn't like, the structure they didn't like at the time. And we didn't talk about it much on the ship. In the wardroom, you don't talk by policy. You don't talk about sex, or you don't talk about religion, and you don't talk about politics.
Okay.
I would have to believe that the chiefs and the officers were certainly patriotic, certainly believed what they were doing was right, and they certainly did it. We had people in my division, FTG3 Weed was one who argued with me that Vietnam was wrong, and I would finally say to him, well, I don't care what you think, we just have to do your duty here while you're in the Navy, and if you then want to leave, go ahead. But it was clearly the people... Clearly, it was a controversy, and I would tell you that after I saw Bang and Chow, it made me wonder if South Vietnam would be able to stand on its own.
Right.
And because I did, these two guys were future naval officers, their Navy was going to be awful weak.
Right.
So that was that. I mean, that's my answer. Those are my answers. Did that cover what you wanted?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. One other question. You mentioned having no desire to go back to Vietnam, to go back over there. But what do you think about this developing American policy towards Vietnam and establishing this relationship with them in trade and a lot of Vietnam veterans going back in tourism? What's your opinion of all of that?
I think if individuals want to go back to see important places in their life, emotional places in life, that's their individual decision. I'm all for it if that's what they want to do. As I said a few minutes ago, my cousin married a woman named Fong.
Mm-hmm.
They have a number of children. One is a major in Special Forces. Another one is a Navy lieutenant flying helicopters off a DDG in the Atlantic. She is a great person. They are a wonderful addition to our family, so individually as people, that's fine. I just have no desire to go back there, but I do see the rise of China as a challenge to America, and I believe that people who think that this will be a peaceful rise of China, I believe they are naive and don't read history. And in that context, I believe that U.S. has a strategic interest in developing relationships with the Vietnamese, who, by and large, have suspicions and concerns with China themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
Strategically, I would support a improved relationship with Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, is there anything else we should cover? Anything else you'd like to say before wrapping the interview up?
I would like to thank you for your patience with me today and yesterday. I hope that my information will be of use to someone sometime somewhere in a project they have. And I would again say that serving in Vietnam was not my intent. It just happened. But my time there, what I did, the experiences, the memories, and I still see them clearly in my mind's eye, formed me and made me helped make me who I am today. And so I'm just glad I had this opportunity and you were patient enough to keep me on your list.
Well, it's been my pleasure talking with you, sir, and I certainly appreciate you taking the time to do this and that you were still interested after all that time.